Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
World Nigga Law.
We have a major visa issue.
The African Economic Summit is usually an opportunity for people to network and talk about trade between the U.S. and Africa. But not many people are here this year, says event organizer Mary Flowers.
Usually we get about 40% that get rejected, but the others come. This year it was 100%, every delegation. And it was sad to see because these people were so disheartened of what happened.
This is the fourth year Flowers has put on this African trade and development event. But in African countries denied attendees visas, about 100 people by her estimation. The countries affected included Sierra Leone, Guinea, Ghana, Nigeria, Ethiopia, and South Africa.
These kinds of things happen that makes it very difficult and challenging for us to connect.
Flowers doesn't know why all of the Africans heading to her event were denied visas this year. But she suspects it has something to do with the broader visa and travel controversy under President Trump. She's appealed to current and former lawmakers, including former Congresswoman Diane Watson.
There are ambassadors that were scheduled to be here at this summit that were denied visas. They rejected their visas. As you know, under the current administration, they are limiting the number of people who come from the continent of Africa into America, and they're denying the visas.
Watson says she has called the State Department to ask for information, but the State Department isn't allowed to discuss individual visa cases. There have been reports of U.S. embassies worldwide denying more travel visas, but it's hard to know for sure. The available State Department data only goes up to last fall.
I have to say that most of us feel that it is a discrimination issue with the African nations because we experience it over and over and over. And the people that are being rejected are people that are legitimate business people with ties to the continent.
People were hoping to do business here, but not much has happened. And organizers vow to get to the bottom of it. For Voice of America at the University of Southern California, this is Michelle Quinn.
Hey. Said, what's the word? Tell me, brother, have you heard? From Johannesburg.
Woodstock is close to Cape Town's famous Table Mountain and is considered an up-and-coming area. Its landmark buildings are being renovated by property developers, old houses too. A new, wealthier type of person is moving in to frequent its new, trendy cafes. But one street away, Woodstock's longtime residents say they're paying the price for the area's gentrification. Charnel and her neighbours are locked in a legal battle against a property developer who wants them out. They say they won't be able to afford the rent on their homes once they're renovated. The city of Cape Town has offered them somewhere else to live, but they don't like it.
If the outcome is that we have to move, Everybody said that they are not going to Wolverhampton, even if it means them staying on the street in the city. Wolverhampton is not a life for no one.
Wolverhampton is 30 kilometres from the city. The mountain is much farther away. So are facilities and employment opportunities. Some of the people here say what's happening to them reminds them of apartheid spatial planning.
Because people were forced from their homes and racially segregated during apartheid, land and housing are very emotional issues in South Africa, which is still deeply divided along economic lines. Many people here say the city's most desirable areas are increasingly becoming places that are only for the rich.
Cape Town's mayor says there's huge demand for social housing, which some of the residents of Woodstock don't qualify for, but she's trying to help them anyway.
If they qualify, and if they are on the waiting list of the city of Cape Town, they will get an opportunity there. So there's nothing about being unfair and unreasonable and acting like the old apartheid government. It's all about the rule of law.
Her vision of the future includes thousands of affordable apartments, which architects have had to include in their pitches for a big downtown development. The circular building is an eye-catching option, but affordability is relative, and the reality is there may never be enough space in the city for everyone who wants to live there. Tanya Page, Al Jazeera, Cape Town.
World. We like maps here on the show. There's nothing like a map to help explain the world. But some maps do a better job of that than others, which is why some social studies teachers right here with Boston's public schools just got new world maps for their classrooms. They're not the traditional Mercator projections of the world that have been around for centuries, you know, where Alaska is larger than most of Western Europe. It's not, by the way. So the classrooms are now getting maps drawn using the Gall-Peters projection. Hayden Frederick Clark is director for cultural proficiency for the Boston Public Schools. So in a nutshell, Hayden, why introduce these new world maps into the schools?
First off, we wanted to make sure that we were doing a good job of affirming our students. 86% of our students are students of color, and many of them have parents, grandparents that are from places on the map that are underscaled and distorted. We wanted to create the opportunity for the students to see themselves in an appropriate fashion and counter the narrative that many of these places are small, insignificant, and not necessarily important to the world and its history, its functions, and its glory, quite frankly.
Why is Gall-Peters more accurate than Mercator?
The why is something that a cartographer would probably be more skilled at explaining. The how I can speak to, I think the most glaring distortion on the Mercator map is the size of Africa. It's entirely too small. In many iterations, it said that Greenland looks about the same size as Africa. The United States looks like it's comparable in size, and we know that that's absolutely not true. Africa is, I believe, is 14 times larger than Greenland. In addition to that, Mexico is smaller than Alaska on a Mercator map. That's also quite backwards. Mexico is actually very much larger. There's problems with Brazil. Europe, and more specifically Germany, are near the center of the map. We know that not to be true. So a simple web search can give you iteration after iteration of distortions on the map. And again, in an effort to be accurate and give students precise information, we didn't want to leave them with that impression for the truth's sake. And we didn't want students who, again, many of them are from the Caribbean, many are descendants of Africa. We didn't want to tell them where you are from is small and insignificant. The marginalization of some of those places in the history books is already a glaring problem. We didn't need another add-on. Then arguably shifting the maps first is a bit easier lift because it doesn't require as much work, and it can something that can resonate with small children as well as older children who have the capacity to grapple with some more difficult issues and more complexities.
You've taught before, right, Hayden?
Yes. But,
yeah. Has the switch from Mercator to Gall-Peters created conversation that you hadn't anticipated, and what kind of questions are you getting?
what I can say from my own experience as an instructor, people enjoy the truth, and people, especially classroom teachers, generally want to give their students the best and most authentic product that they can. So I do not anticipate we'll get anything other than surprise and awe and arguably a push to do more of these right. things to uncover some of the things that we accept as true. But when we dig a little bit deeper, there's a more complicated story.
Hayden Frederick Clark is the Director of Cultural Proficiency for Boston Public Schools. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Former East Tennessee State University student who police say disrupted an on-campus Black Lives Matter rally while wearing a gorilla mask and carrying a rope and bananas. Tristan Retke has been indicted on 2 counts of civil rights intimidation and 2 counts of disorderly conduct and disrupting a meeting. That is according to Assistant District Attorney Aaron McCardle. Now, witnesses testified that Retke used racial slurs, intimidated them, and made them fearful. His attorney says Retke was exercising his freedom of speech and did not intimidate anyone.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
We can help you out.
Angry parents demanding answers from Cobb County school officials. At issue, a racist threat promising to exterminate black people with mass genocide. The profanity-laced Snapchat message was passed around recently at North Cobb High School. Parents demanding more time at tonight's school board meeting to talk about the safety of their children. The board ended up giving them an extra minute, but parents say that's all they did because they didn't take action. Fox 5 was the only station in the Cobb County for tonight's meeting, and that's where we find Fox 5's Nathalie Pozo. Nathalie?
Well, Tom, the Cobb County superintendent did open up tonight's meeting by saying that the district's top priority is the safety of all children, but the parents who packed the meeting here don't believe that to be the case. They tell me they are seriously offended by this post and feel the school board is not taking it seriously.
And we hope that you all will look further into this so that we don't have another Columbine on our hands.
Cobb County parents say they fear for the safety and the lives of their children. After a post on social media, school officials say a student at North Cobb High School posted. Parents believe the school district took the post too lightly.
It's not a black or a white thing. It is a safety thing for all children at North Cobb High School.
In the tirade flooded with profanity and the N-word, the male student referred to pulling a Hitler and exterminating black people with a mass genocide. At the Cobb County School Board meeting Thursday, one parent read the post, as she says, so the board could hear it out loud and understand why parents are so troubled about it.
We were told it's not a threat, not a specific threat. That's just ridiculous.
Parents say the notification they received from the school was vague, and they're still waiting on answers as to what, if any, action the school has taken.
Like, now, what's going on in this school? And then what is the resolution to this problem? And they wouldn't talk to us because of privacy.
Members of the NAACP and SCLC attended the meeting, saying they will be there all the way with these parents.
And we will do what is necessary to make sure that the board attends to them and respects them.
And one school board member after the public comment portion did say that because of the way it works, they can't engage in a conversation, but he did say that he heard what the parents were saying. I did ask a school spokesperson here tonight if any disciplinary action has been taken. She could not comment on that, only to say it's an ongoing investigation. Reporting live tonight in Cobb County, Nathalie Pozo, Fox 5 News.
Nathalie, thanks.
I thought I asked for an African-American to replace Terry.
You requested an Afro-American?
African-American. Jerry, you know I did. I put it in writing.
I didn't see it. You see it?
If you don't like her, you send her back.
Yeah, you tell her you didn't like her performance because she was white.
What? That's not the point.
Flipper, she's been here for 5 minutes. Give her a chance. This sounds dangerously like reverse discrimination to me.
New at 5, a former school resource officer is claiming he is the victim of discrimination and is now suing the Clayton County School District.
Yeah, we're talking about Micah Brown, who's white, and he says he overlooked discrimination from a supervisor because he loved his work. But he says now he has no other choice but to file a lawsuit. Latasha Givens has a story you'll see only on 11 Alive.
I was injured in the line of duty.
School resource officer Micah Brown says he was chasing a high school student.
We were executing that warrant and then trying to get him ready to transport. In the process, we fell off of a wall, a retaining wall, and when I landed, I hurt my knee.
He says a torn meniscus, ripped ACL, and other injuries put him out of commission. In December 2014, he was placed on workers' compensation leave. According to Brown's medical records obtained by 11 Alive News, doctors recommended knee surgery and estimated 6 to 9 months of healing time. But then he received a call from work.
I was notified that I had to return to active duty. Told them that, you know, that was not possible. They, you know, the doctor, which was their doctor, their workers' comp doctor, had not released me.
His attorney, Micah Berry, accuses the district of breaking the law.
They backdated the FMLA in violation of federal law. They refused to give any light duty, and they gave 30 days of leave after they backdated his federal entitlement so that he would be just 2 weeks shy of the end of the school year, and then they fired him.
Brown's lawsuit claims he was the only white resource officer in Clayton County schools, and race played a role in his termination.
So you felt like this particular supervisor had something against you?
Yes.
And you think it had to do with race?
Yes.
Brown says a series of events, including a poor evaluation and singling him out on work assignment protocols, are his proof, detailed in this EEOC complaint.
The only white officer you have suddenly got treated this way. I mean, what reason do you have? And they haven't even tried to give a reason.
Through an open records request, 11 Alive was able to obtain Brown's personnel file. In that file, we found this letter giving the okay to terminate him due to exhaustion of FMLA and ADA leave.
Now, Brown says because of the termination on his record, it's been difficult to find work in law enforcement. We reached out to Clayton County School District for comment, but they declined.
Tacky, trashy, terroristic. That is the interaction with black people and white people every day, wherever they happen to be. It's going to be one of those categories, a combination of all three, before the day is over. But it doesn't get any better than tacky. I call it the three T's. Tacky, trashy, terroristic. That's it. Anywhere on the planet you are.
Flynn family claims that somebody wrote threats and a racial slur on their front door. Terry Holmes said he found his home vandalized this morning. The words leave or die and the N-word written there across the front door.
Nigga!
Terry and his wife, an interracial couple, have lived on Monty Lane for years. They say they're now disappointed that somebody would do this.
I'm not going to leave, you know, unless I choose to leave, you know, so I'm not going to leave because of threats. You know, I'm going to take precautions. I already have updated some security precautions around here.
The Polk County Sheriff's Office is investigating.
Okay. Wendy, hot and juicy redhead. We'll give this a try.
Wendy's.
Hello, Wendy. This is Kevin's friend, Michael.
This isn't Wendy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Could you put her on, please?
Dude, this is a Wendy's restaurant.
A racial slur found printed on a fast food receipt by a Florida Highway Patrol trooper. He says he discovered it at a Wendy's restaurant in Orlando. Now News 6 reporter Eric Sandoval is getting answers.
We found out that we were the ones that actually alerted the franchise owner and Wendy's corporate about this racial slur printed on this receipt. And that sparked an investigation that lasted most of Thursday.
You always hear about things like this, but you never think it would be you.
This Florida Highway Patrol trooper said he had to do a double take when he saw an old receipt laying next to a cash register inside this Wendy's restaurant at the corner of Rouse Road and University Boulevard in Orlando last night.
I said, I didn't just see that.
Take a look. The name the Wendy's worker had given a customer was a racial slang word that started with the letter N.
I said, if my kids were here eating dinner,
nigga!
And I had to show them this receipt, or they saw this receipt, my six-year-old's learning to read. And the first thing he would say is, what is this word?
Uneasy, the trooper said he walked up to place his order.
He was very cordial with me, and that was what really shocked me, because I thought for sure that it was going to be, okay, if this is sitting here for an hour or however long it was, how is he going to treat me?
He says the worker even thanked him for his service, but not before the trooper snapped this picture of the receipt and sent it to News 6. We contacted Wendy's corporate tonight, and they told us while this receipt wasn't directed toward anyone in particular, we take this very seriously and find the language to be offensive and not in line with our values. This was a terrible judgment call by one of our employees. It's completely unacceptable, and we no longer employ this individual. Now, this trooper says he is sure that he is not the only one who saw this receipt, and he says he's not sure he's going to go back to that Wendy's or any other Wendy's restaurant. That is, until he sees the company properly train its employees. We're in the newsroom. Eric Sandoval, News 6.
Black babies cost less.
Here is a recent headline from the Washington Post. Black teens are reported missing, and far too few people notice. Earlier this month, there was a spate of reports here in D.C. of black teenagers who'd vanished. But the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and law enforcement agencies say the number of missing kids in D.C. is in line with the numbers in other American cities. They say what has changed is that there's now a more sustained effort to get the word out about teens who have gone missing. Joining me here in studio to talk about what's going on is Julia Craven of the Huffington Post. She's been covering the story. Julia, welcome to 1A. I appreciate you coming in.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start out with the big question here. What is going on in Washington, D.C. with these missing teenagers?
Well, right now, MPD is, they're publicizing when these girls go missing, or when these teenagers go missing. It's both genders. And the number of missing person cases hasn't increased in the district. It's right along with what we see nationwide. It's actually down a little bit. And the real difference is that they're publicizing these cases. However, on the community side, they don't care about that. They're looking at it like, we didn't know that this was the number, and we don't care about the number. We care about the fact that there are teenagers who are going missing for a myriad of reasons, whether they're running away from something, whether they're running to something.
Okay, so the police are looking at numbers. The community is frantic anyway. Let me start with something that I'm very curious about. Why is the D.C. Police Department publicizing these cases all of a sudden?
Well, they got a new chief of their youth and division services. Her name is Chanel Dickerson, and she has pledged that she is going to make sure that every child who is critically missing gets some type of publicity, whether it be a Twitter, whether it be a Facebook, and if necessary, widespread media attention, like if there's a case of, like we saw with Relisha Rudd 3 years ago.
So this is obviously a good initiative, but it has had the unintended consequence of making people think, or apparently making people think, that many more kids are going missing than were before.
Right.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about something that really does seem to have the D.C. community concerned, which is a racial disparity in the number of children who are going missing. Can you talk to me a little bit about the numbers that are making people convinced that this is happening in some communities but not in others?
Yes. So MPD has not provided, or at least not to my knowledge, they haven't provided a racial breakdown of the teenagers who are going missing. However, if you keep seeing tweets about all of these missing black and brown girls, there's going to be a lot of cause for concern. And there are tensions between MPD and the black community here, specifically in Ward 8, that's Southeast D.C.
And that's where a lot of these kids are going missing.
Right, that's where a lot of these kids are going missing from. So the community members are very concerned. They're rightfully concerned. And when you couple that with the tensions that already exist between the police and these communities, it's just like, okay, here's another issue where you're not looking out for us. And this is something that we care about. We care about our babies. Like, we want them to come home. If they're running away, why are they running away from home? Why do they have this history? Do we need better mental health services? Do we need to take this child out of this environment? Is this a good environment for this child? Or are they being lured by human traffickers off the internet? So it could be anything.
A lot of very, very scary thoughts for parents.
Right. And MPD does close 95% of missing persons cases. But still, like, people don't care about that. Like, they want the issue to stop.
I want to bring someone else into the conversation. We have on the line with us from Milwaukee, Robert Lowry Jr. He is vice president of the Missing Children Division of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. He also worked as an assistant police chief in the suburbs of St. Louis. Robert, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me on. And again, I apologize for being a little late coming in. I was having troubles with the phone here.
Not a problem at all, Bob. Let me ask you something. We've been talking locally about a perception in D.C. that more kids are going missing. Julie has been telling us a little bit about how it may just be more publicity. But when we look at the national picture, where does D.C. stack up in terms of the numbers of missing kids?
Well, you know, I do start us a conversation by saying that one child missing is too many. But I do agree. I did join in and I heard Julia's comments that the numbers are actually going slightly down. The D.C. numbers of missing children are fairly consistent with what we see in major cities around the country. It's typically going to be especially runaway children, which attribute for about 85% of those reports. To the family abductions, to abducted children. And I do want to talk about those classifications because it's very important when we're talking about children who are going missing that we keep those kinds of things in mind, because this is sometimes what drives our media attention to this. But I also want to follow up is that we do applaud Commander Dickerson and her efforts to bring attention to all missing children. So we know that the conversation has gotten very spirited, but we think it's a good conversation to have, because any attention that we can get to this issue of missing children, the better, because we need the public's help in getting these children back to safe places.
Speaking of Commander Dickerson, who commands D.C. Police's Youth and Family Division, she's new on the job. One of our colleagues at the WAMU newsroom asked her a question yesterday. She asked, why might these girls be missing?
The Amber Alert is the early public notification system where law enforcement agencies use to notify the public where we believe that a juvenile has been kidnapped and is in physical danger. So a lot of people were asking why we didn't issue out Amber Alerts in those cases. So I just wanted to put the criteria out there. We have no evidence that any of these missing teens have been kidnapped.
I mean, Bob, we'll get back to the question of why they might be missing in a second, but let's talk a little bit about the Amber Alert system and why it is so important. I know that sometimes I'll be sitting at work and my cell phone and Amber Alert will come up, and I always think, does this thing really help?
Oh, absolutely. I think Amber Alert has been a big game changer when it comes to finding critically missing children. Commander Dickerson is correct, and just by way of background, is that we do oversee the secondary Amber Alert system, which has been administered through the Department of Justice and is present in all 50 states. But it does have a few requirements, and it can become confusing. One is it has to involve the abduction of a child, and a child, of course, under the federal definition is a child under the age of 18. The second criteria is that the child's life has to be in physical danger, either a physical injury or death. And the third criteria, which becomes the more difficult one to understand, is there enough information that we can share through an Amber Alert with the public to aid in the recovery of that child and getting them back to a safe place? So there's actually three criteria that's required. And, of course, I think Commander Dickerson is correct. Not every child that's missing rises to the level of Amber Alert, but can during the episode of the missing, and I can get in more depth on the risk these children face.
We're discussing missing children with Julia Craven, a reporter from the Huffington Post, and Robert Lowry of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Now, Julia, you have been in these communities talking to parents in Southwest D.C. where children are going missing. And one of the things that you brought up is a sense that there is a racial disparity. There are more Black and brown teens going missing than there are white teens. Is the fear that the police, law enforcement, are not taking this as seriously because these kids are coming from communities of color? Or is there enough trust to say maybe the numbers are outsized because these kids are suffering at home?
So
it's a hard question.
It is a tough question. Black parents, Black people, Black and brown people, we know what we know. And the fact of the matter is that when you have a strained relationship with the police department, when you feel as though you can't trust the police to come in and even police your communities properly without inflicting unnecessary violence on someone, when there's such a deep distrust between these two groups of people, it boils over into other issues. So I would say the sense is that there's not really a whole lot of trust here for the police department. And that was evident at the town hall last night. Tensions flared up. The community had a lot of questions. And it kind of seemed like the government officials who were there they kind of had a tendency to speak on the availability of resources versus the accessibility and how it's not necessarily feasible for a working parent to check in with their child all of the time or monitor their kids on social media all of the time. So there seems to be this gap almost between the community and the police department. And one thing that I do just want to briefly loop back to when we were talking about Amber Alerts is that there is a racial disparity in Amber Alerts. We do not see Amber Alerts for Black and brown girls. So I just wanted to also make that known.
I ain't saying I like the Democrats. I don't. It sure as hell don't know what the fuck they do.
Donna Brazile was challenged by our own Jordan Chariton that she had leaked emails, or she had leaked questions, I should say, to Hillary Clinton before one of the debates. And this was in some of the leaked emails that we found out through WikiLeaks. Now, Jordan was the first person to notice those emails among the WikiLeaks documents. He was the first one to tweet about it publicly. He was the first one to ask CNN about it. He was the first one to ask Donna Brazile about it, and he broke the story. And at the time, Donna Brazile denied it. Well, the story has changed now. She now says that she regrets it. Now, I'm going to show you exactly what she said in regards to changing her story. But first, even Fox News Channel gives credit to Jordan and showing exactly how Donna Brazile misled on the story. So here, let's go to that clip real quick. And our clip is within the Fox News segment here.
What Donna Brazile did was shameful and treasonous to our political system and stability, even threatening to journalism in America. At least CNN, for their part, demanded her resignation immediately. But let's now take a look at what she told Jordan Chariton on the street denying those accusations. Listen.
Do you owe the voters an apology for passing a question for a town hall off to the Hillary Clinton campaign?
Sir, you know what? I wish when you got your facts, you read the emails. And
I did read a lot of them.
Well, you clearly did not read my email, sir. No one has ever shared questions with any of us involved in CNN.
In fact, Greg, Donna Brazile denied it on several occasions.
So, Young Turks broke that story, and it turns out we were right. Now, Donna Brazile writing in Time saying, look, first she tries to give a context. She says, referring to the Russian hacking of the DNC emails in the first place, she says, these malicious attacks were not a momentary cyber intrusion. These attacks were coordinated by a foreign adversary and executed for over a year with devastating results for those of us who were targeted, and ultimately for every American. And she was targeted. So let's give a proper context here. Number one, Boling goes way over the top by saying it's treasonous. It was wrong. We were the first ones to point out it was wrong. We were right to get CNN to take action on it. I think they were right to remove her. Treasonous is needlessly over the top. Okay, now, secondarily, By the way, doing an actual deal with the Russians, that's what you would call treasonous. Now, let's see if there's more investigations that come out on that. What we found out today through James Comey, that in fact the FBI is investigating just such a deal. And that's what Donna Brazile is referring to here. Now, the people have broken off into two different camps here. One is the Russian leak, Russian interference in our election is no big deal, and it's all fear-mongering, and we should not worry about that at all. We should not focus on that at all. And the other camp is the Russians did it, and that's the only thing we should focus on, and that's the only reason the Democrats lost the election. I'm not in either one of those camps. I think the Russians did clearly interfere in our election. They didn't hack the vote. They leaked emails. The emails were true. We should investigate if the Trump administration actually, or in the past, of course, the Trump campaign coordinated with the Russians. If they did, again, that would be a much more serious crime. And luckily, the FBI, apparently, we find out today, is investigating that. That doesn't mean that Donna Brazile was right in leaking questions to Hillary Clinton. She frames it as helping the Democratic Party. But if it was helping the Democratic Party, why didn't she also leak questions to Bernie Sanders? Okay, now let's go to her clarification slash apology here. She said that in October, a subsequent release of emails revealed that among the many things I did in my role as a Democratic operative and DNC vice chair, prior to assuming the interim DNC chair position, was to share potential town hall topics with the Clinton campaign. I had been working behind the scenes to add more town hall events and debates to the primary calendar, and I helped ensure those events included diverse moderators and addressed topics vital to minority communities. My job was to make all our Democratic candidates look good, and I worked closely with both campaigns to make that happen. But sending those emails was a mistake I will forever regret. Okay, so there you have it. So for the folks who said, oh no, TYT, you don't know what you're doing, the WikiLeaks is all wrong, it's all Russians and this and that, you were wrong. Those emails were real. She did leak the questions to Hillary Clinton, and now she says she regrets it. Now, she tries to give it context and say, hey, look, I did other things that were really good. And guys, that's true. This is not the only thing Donna Brazile has ever done in her life. She's done a lot of great things. And she's largely on our side, meaning the progressive side. And that one thing does not erase her entire record. But that also does not excuse what she did. No matter all the great things she did in the past, this was clearly a terrible mistake. And I do not accept it was just to help the Democratic Party. Because if it was, like I said, you would have leaked equally. You would have also told them to Bernie Sanders, but you didn't. So now she gets more into that. She says, by stealing all the DNC's emails and then selectively releasing those few, the Russians made it look like I was in the tank for Secretary Clinton. Despite the strong public support I received from top Sanders campaign aides in the wake of those leaks, the media narrative played out just as the Russians had hoped, leaving Sanders supporters understandably angry and sowing division in our ranks. In reality, not only was I not playing favorites, the more competitive and heated the primary got, the harder the DNC staff worked to be scrupulously fair and beyond reproach. Again, agree and disagree. You have to look at the whole record, and I'm sure that she can point to areas where she was fair and even, and the Sanders campaign to some degree agrees with her. So they're not making it up, and she's not making it up. On the other hand, there were other times when she was not fair, when she leaked to only one side. And it's not great evidence to say that the Sanders campaign didn't complain much. The Sanders campaign, if you ask me, didn't complain much about anything. So they still played within the Democratic rules, and they were way, way too polite in how they fought back against Hillary Clinton. That is my opinion. So now, in terms of what happened, again, it doesn't really change any of this. Yes, it is true that the Russians did, in some way, according to our best intelligence, help in some way to release those emails. Some say there's still not enough evidence. That I don't care. The emails are true. And I am worried that the Russians and Trump campaign work together. FBI is investigating that. Okay, but overall, the point is, you shouldn't have leaked the emails to Hillary Clinton, because that's exactly what people were complaining about. And as you say, they are justifiably angry, because it looked like the entire Democratic establishment was unfairly on Bernie Sanders' side. because they were.
Yeah, and since we talking about ropes, white folks, what you know about ropes? Yeah, what you know about trees and men swinging from them that look like me?
An employee at the Seminole County Clerk's office was just suspended after he posted on social media saying State Attorney Irma Sayala should face the death penalty, but he didn't stop there. He also said she should be tarred and feathered. Channel 9's Cuthbert Langley took this post to the county clerk to find out what's being done.
The clerk for Seminole County confirms to us the employee at the center of all of this is the assistant finance director working out of this building. He's now been placed on administrative leave with pay after posting those comments last night.
I was disgusted.
Last night, Jennifer Jacobs found these two comments written about State Attorney Aramis Ayala after her decision to not seek the death penalty in any case. We confirm they were written by Stan McCullers, an employee with the Seminole County Clerk and Comptroller's Office. The first comment read, maybe she should get the death penalty. The second said she should be tarred and feathered, if not hung from a tree. Ayala is the first African-American state attorney in Florida.
He was calling for a lynch mob. That's what it sounds like.
After realizing who wrote the comments, Jacob sent them to McCullers' boss, Seminole County Clerk of Courts Grant Malloy. He told me he was disappointed when he read them this morning.
Comments that are, racist or demeaning are not welcome from our office. We don't accept that. It doesn't represent who we are.
So Malloy placed him on administrative leave with pay while they investigate, a decision Jacobs disagrees with. She wants McCullers fired.
But I don't know that anyone's going to be able to do any further investigation, and I'm not sure what investigation is necessary. They speak for themselves.
But Malloy said he has to let the investigation play out before making any permanent decision. We went to the home believed to be McCullers today, but no one answered. He has since deleted his Facebook and Twitter. But before that, we found this tweet apparently from him saying it was wrong of me to post that. I let my anger at her efforts to thwart justice get the best of me. No excuse. Cuthbert Langley, Channel 9 Eyewitness News.
We reached out to Irma Sayala's office today, and a spokesperson said they have filed a formal complaint with the Seminole County Clerk's office.
How we look at the world is shaped by many different things: gender, social class, religion, the list goes on. My next guest looks at race and its effect on society. Sarah Gaither studies how growing up with multiple racial identities informs the way people see themselves and how they interact with others. Sarah is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. She'll be part of a panel discussion at Duke next week with other multiracial professors in the Triangle. But first, she joins me live in the studio to talk about her work. Welcome to the program, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your research aims to look at the benefits of diversity within society. Do you feel too much research focuses on the disadvantages of diversity? And tell us about how you approach that.
Yeah, I think today a lot of our research really has focused on the negative consequences stemming from interacting with people who are different. It's really easy to focus on the negative things in life. And so what I try to do a lot of my work is to try and highlight some of the positive things that can come from interacting with diverse others. And so by studying biracial individuals with their multiple racial backgrounds and who they're exposed to, it really is a key way to look at how intergroup contact can actually benefit anyone, no matter what their backgrounds may or may not be.
You also look at identity flexibility within biracial people. What does identity flexibility look like in practice?
So it's a little hard to define that. It's different actually for everyone. But what I usually study on is if you get people to think about one of their identities over the other in a given moment, that can impact your behavior in different ways. It can impact how you talk to someone, how you interact with someone, how you categorize someone. And so what I look at a lot in my work is if you get someone to think about one of their racial identities, so their black identity, let's say, over their white identity, identity. I find that that helps them interact with other Black individuals better than having them think about a different racial identity than they might have from someone else. So it really does highlight some of the flexibility and perspective-taking abilities that people who have multiple backgrounds with which to identify, it can give them a benefit in different types of diverse settings.
More tools in their toolbox.
Yes, more tools in their toolbox, but not tools that I don't think anyone can't have, right? So recently I've been extending some of my work outside of just multiracial identities to show that we all have multiple identities, right? So any of us can have this ability to activate multiple pathways to identify with people who are different. I just think biracials might have a unique pathway compared to other people.
You're biracial as well. You grew up in a mixed race household in Sacramento, California. Tell us about your upbringing and how your parents encouraged your multiracial identity.
Yeah, so I grew up in a half white, half Black family. So my father's Black, my mother is white. I also have a younger brother who looks a little more racially mixed than I do. For those of you who don't know what I look like, I look pretty much like a white person. So it's been a really interesting experience growing up, looking white, yet identifying as a Black individual as well. I didn't have a Black experience growing up. I wasn't prepared socially through my parents on experiencing different types of discrimination that a Black individual would often face. But my parents did make a real effort in trying to make sure they knew I was lots of different things at the same time. So half my toys were white, half my toys were Black. And I think that really shaped my flexibility in thinking about race as a category and social identities more broadly.
But you also witnessed how your mother and father were treated differently in society. When you were in school, other kids would mistake your father for your driver.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. So I went to a predominantly white school growing up. It was largely high income children as well there. My dad was really one of the few Black people those children ever saw. He was a bus driver for the city of Sacramento. And so showing up to pick me up from school, the other classmates of mine used to assume he was my actual catered driver, a hired driver, simply because our skin tones don't match. There's really not very many features on me that match me to my father. So that was a difficult experience growing up, and one that I sort of always had to reassert the fact that he really was my biological father. Constant questions of, are you sure you're not the milkman's kid or something like that, were also very constant things that I faced during my childhood.
Did you say to these kids, no, I mean, do you feel like you were having to prove yourself to them?
Yeah, I think you do feel like that. I think lots of people who are mixed and don't necessarily look like what they may be biologically from their parents, it's a sense of self. It's a sense of identity. So when you have that constant pressure from people questioning your identity, it really does take a toll on you. So you do feel that you need to validate your sense of self. So since then, I've actually carried around a family photo in my wallet. To this day, I have it with me right here in the studio to sort of prove to people I really do have an interracial family, because it's something that's continued to sort of plague my existence from an identity angle since then.
I mean, I don't know how old you are, but I would imagine that after you get out of school, you deal with this for a couple of decades and you just want to tell the you get angry. You're not so nice about it anymore. You just say, you know.
Yeah, I think that happens for some people. And that's one thing that I'm trying to study in some of my work right now, looking at biracial experiences more broadly. I think over time, I've ended up adopting my multiracial identity in a much more positive way. So being able to research these experiences and knowing that there's not very many researchers out there trying to figure out why it is biracial people have higher rates of social exclusion than other racial and ethnic groups, that I think has served as a positive tool for me to know that the work I'm doing really can highlight a story that I think is a little more unique for the biracial demographic.
How did your perceptions of your multiracial identity change as you got older? Did you see them when you were in high school being differently as when you were in elementary school?
So I actually went to the same school my entire life, kindergarten through high school. The classes changed slightly over time. I did gain confidence in my identity. I think over time you get more and more confident in reasserting your identity. Once I got to college, I went to UC Berkeley in California. I did join some mixed race student groups there. And so there was sort of the first time that I really started exploring my multiracial identity. Two of my best friends growing up were also biracial, half white, half Black, and half white, half Asian. So having those two as part of my childhood friendships also helped me positively identify. But it really wasn't until college and then through graduate school and knowing I could study this for a living that it really re-solidified my identity.
What was the thing that prompted you to go into this as a researcher?
I think it was honestly growing up in such a mixed race household and knowing that just the skin tone between my mom and my father dictated their experiences, what types of jobs they were offered, who dated them. It really highlighted the role that skin tone and appearance plays in shaping the expectations that we have when interacting with people who are different. And myself looking so white and yet identifying internally as something else really does show how complex identity really is. And so it was really a combination of those things, and knowing that my brother had different experiences than I did, even though we were both biracial black white individuals at the same time.
Was there any contention within your household between you and your brother, just by the way that you looked, you know, different experiences you were having by your physical appearance? Was that anything that you spoke about?
He and I talked about, he's about 2.5 years younger than I am. He was definitely socialized and prepared for bias more than I was, because he looks more African-American than I do. I actually was jealous growing up of him because he looked more racially mixed. So he looked how I identified internally, and yet I could never claim a black identity as easily as he could. So we always had sort of pseudo competitions, friendly ones always, about those differences. But I ended up focusing on school as a way to highlight my identity in different ways that I couldn't externally based on how I look.
One of the first studies you did focused on pairing white college students with non-white students as roommates. Tell us about that study and what it tells us about the effect of interracial interactions.
Yeah, so that was a project I did for my master's work at Tufts University in Boston with Sam Summers. And so what we were interested there is, if you live with someone from another racial background in that very meaningful college dorm experience, it's a very small setting, how does that experience shape your future behavior in interacting with a black individual you've never met before? So in that study, we had white first-year roommates who lived with other white same-race roommates versus white first-years who lived with anyone but a white individual. What we found was just that meaningful experience at the end of their first year of college, they were able to interact with much less anxiety, more positive eye contact, they had more diverse friends, and they could talk about racial-related issues in a much more positive way, showing that there really can be some very strong, powerful contact effects that can transfer into future behavioral tendencies. So this was really some of the first work to show that meaningful contact across racial group lines really can show positive benefits and not necessarily just negative ones.
So you fucked a Negro in college,
hey,
and...
Excuse me. Let's keep this above the belt, okay? Show a little respect for this woman.
Yes, yes. Continue, oh great niggerologist. Enlighten us. 'Cause I'm a liar.
From Texas, who accused three mass black men of raping her, has now come forward and confessed that she made the whole thing up. Now, this is 18-year-old Brianna Talbot from Denison, Texas. And this all occurred after she stumbled into a church with cuts and bruises. Let me give you more details on that. She was reported missing on March 8th by her then fiance, who told police he found her car in the parking lot of her apartment complex with the driver door open and her phone, keys, and a single shoe nearby. Hours later, she stumbled into a local church half naked and covered in cuts. She apparently told witnesses at the church that she had been kidnapped and sexually assaulted in the woods behind the church. There were also visible cuts and or scratches on her body. Well, she not only made the whole thing up, the injuries that she had were self-inflicted. So I don't know what her motive was or why she would make this up, but it's so incredibly damaging on so many different levels. Not only is the community scared because they think that there are three men on the loose who are, you know, raping people, but it also, you know, continues to perpetuate stereotypes about the black community. And it also leads to people just completely denying or being skeptical of individuals who come forward and say that they've been raped or sexually assaulted. So she's a terrible person, and she is facing charges as a result of falsifying these reports.
Brianna really didn't want to marry her fiance. She came back with the stories, but she, you know what? This is something that has been historically a culture of white women who accuse black men when they and get black men in trouble, like the woman that accused Emmett Till, who just admitted years and years and years later. But even when you think about the Black Wall Street in Oklahoma, that the reason why it was taken down, it was because a woman said she was assaulted by a black man. And this has been something that has been, black men have been targeted by this narrative and this false narrative for many years. And I'm not saying that some black men don't rape and don't abuse and don't do, but this has been something that has been handed down from generation to generation of white women accusing black men falsely and black men paying the price. And it is disgusting that black men are being targeted from all directions. You got the homeless man getting killed. You got this girl. You got the prison, the school to prison system. There we have a shortage of black men. This is something that those of us who are the mothers of black men, this is what keeps us up at night. My son goes out with a white girl, and I have to say, be careful if you get pulled over by the cops. You cannot be aggressive. This is the kind of stuff that is disgusting, and it is tiring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's amazing how powerful the media is and how long of an effect that it has. Yeah. Because Birth of a Nation, the first feature-length film, had a white guy in blackface kidnapping white women.
Yeah.
And so they told people, hey, be afraid of the black guy. He's going to kidnap and rape your women. And by the way, the KKK didn't do cross burnings until they saw it in the movie. And then they're like, oh, that's cool. Let's do that.
Right.
You see, and then that's why when people say, oh, history doesn't matter, why are you guys still harping on it? Because that history rains down on us through the generations. And all the way down to Denison, Texas, where this girl, when she thinks, what story am I going to make up? I'm going to make up the oldest story in American history, which is three black guys came and gang raped me and took me, and I'm going to go to the core of what my community is scared of.
Right.
Because yeah. They've been taught to be scared of it. And I'm going to get sympathy or whatever else she thought she was going to get. But I want to give a huge credit to the authorities here.
Yeah.
Okay, so cops, credit where credit is due, they're like, wait, three guys in ski masks that you conveniently couldn't identify.
Right.
And
also kidnapped her in a big black SUV that no one saw as well.
Yes.
A lot of information.
They knew that the story was fishy from the beginning, and we have to applaud them for doing a proper investigation and figuring out what the truth is.
And a lot of times in the past, is that they would have given into the hysteria. But now the good news about some of what has happened today is that they didn't give into the hysteria, so there's been some progress, and they're like, not buying it, and they went to go corroborate the things that she was saying, and nothing could be corroborated, and then she's like, okay, fine, I made it up.
So again, it perpetuates, you know, these stereotypes about different communities, and some people will never know what the truth is. It's so incredibly damaging.
You're right, Anna, and I want to go back to your first point because of the double whammy here. It's not just about race. 98% of reported rapes are real.
Right.
2% are proven to be false,
right,
like this one. But when you have a situation like this, when she does such an outrageously false accusation of rape, then it taints the other 98% that are actually true. So she's done damage to women, to blacks, etc. And, you know, a lot of people are going to see some version of this headline.
Yeah.
Some are going to see the part where, oh, the three black thugs did this. They're never going to see the correction. And other people are going to see the final result and go, oh, you see that? When they say rape, it's a lot of times not rape.
Yep.
And it's going to get disproportionate coverage. So once you set that in motion, even if you at some point admit it, you can't undo the damage that you've done.
Yeah.
You've been on this program so many times and you have theorized that you think there could be an increase in the shootings and what have you, even Walter Scott, that there could be an increase in this sort of violence against the black people because of the increasing promotion and seeming increasing incidence of particularly black males being engaged in sexual intercourse with white females. The fact that the suspected terrorist in this case, the fact that he's reported to have said, hey, you all are sleeping with our women and taking over, does that further bolster your claim that you think that's driving, accelerating more of these types of incidents?
Well, see, again, you can't play basketball or football or tennis without understanding the game that you're playing. Chess or checkers, you can't play without understanding the game that you are playing. And we have to, if we understand racism, white supremacy, as in my thesis, there's no other thesis out explaining racism, white supremacy, other than my work. And I'm not saying this as a braggart,
because I've advertised in the newspaper. Does anybody know, does anybody have a better explanation of this phenomenon that we are, this destructive, deadly phenomenon that we're dealing with? And there's no other explanation out there. And so if we are not functioning with an understanding of exactly and precisely what it is that we're dealing with, which is why Neely Fuller says, if you don't understand white supremacy racism, what it is and exactly how it works, everything else that you think you understand will only confuse you. You see, we have to have a thesis. We have to have a narrative of exactly what it is that we're dealing with if we have the intention to solve the problem. If we don't have the intention to solve racism and white supremacy, then we are content with being victims, content with being slaves, and saying it's nothing we can do about it. As a matter of fact, one of the relatives, I think, that was interviewed by Anderson Cooper, the cousin of the minister who was killed and the state's senator, she said, all we can do is just pray. That's the only thing that we can do about it. Well, you know, it's not a slap in the face of anybody's religion. But people who classify themselves as white don't say it's all that they can do is pray when they start carrying out behavior for their genetic survival, whatever that is.
Okay, we do have one more social media note, and it's a serious one. The founder of the neo-Nazi website, The Daily Stormer, is asking supporters to use the hashtag I'll Ride With You and accompany white supremacists to work to protect them from discrimination. Now, this is because the New York City police say that a man that police are calling a white supremacist told them that he traveled to New York from Baltimore with the intent of killing as many black men as he could, and he confessed to killing one, 66-year-old Timothy Kaufman, on Monday night. The Daily Stormer founder Andrew Anglin says 28-year-old James Harris Jackson, the suspect, does not represent his religion of white supremacy. Well, white supremacists are upset, but our next guest asks, why aren't others? New York Times columnist Jim Dwyer joins us now. And Jim, the title of your piece today is Another Murderer Crazed by Color, This Time Met by Silence. Flesh that out. What do you mean?
About 2 years ago, December of 2015, a man came up from Baltimore armed to the teeth and came to Brooklyn and walked up to a police car and shot the officers in cold-blooded ambush.
Terrible.
And he was entirely motivated by hate of cops. And he, all he could see was blue. As it happened, he killed a Latino and an Asian cop. To me, it seemed very striking that after that terrible episode, there was enormous amounts of recriminations from big public figures in New York, including the former governor and the former mayor and others, and front pages in many of the papers, attacking, among others, Mayor de Blasio, President Obama, Attorney General Holder at the time, all of them being implicated, according to these critics, because they had been supportive of some of the reforms that were being proposed about police and citizen interaction in the wake of some of the shootings like the one in South Carolina and elsewhere. So this time around, nobody said boo.
Well, we should say that today New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio did call the attack a domestic terrorist attack. He was speaking on the Brian Lehrer show on WNYC. But you're right. We've even had these discussions in our meetings. You know, we should be doing this story. And there's just a wave of other news, as you know.
Yeah, there is a wave of other news, and it's, you know, always convenient to find something to distract us from a really horrible subject. This case involves a man. We don't know a lot about his background, the person who's been accused of the crime, but he seems to have been harboring this really anti-black rage for a while. The cops and prosecutors say he was upset about white women mixing with black men. And he's now reached a point where he could, you know, feel himself free to come to New York and murder a person in a really horrible way. I mean, not that there's any good way to do it, but he, you know, he came up with a sword and stabbed this poor man who was just walking along the street collecting cans. And he had intentions, at least what he told the police, so we're informed, that he would go to Times Square and kill more black men.
Now, this is the man that he killed, 66-year-old Timothy Kaufman, a genial, well-known man in his neighborhood who volunteered, who lived in the same home that his pastor father had lived in, who was collecting cans. So you point out there's not enough attention being paid to this man's life, Timothy Kaufman, who was killed. But also the way many people are treating James Jackson, who again said he came to New York to kill black men, is by asking if it's a mental health issue. You make the point that others have made that when it's a white person killing in hatred, people ask if it's mental health. They don't tend to ask that of a black person killing in hatred.
Well, look, the man who killed the two cops had actually tried to commit suicide that day himself. So he clearly was deranged. And what was driving him? Those are valid subjects for investigation. I don't think the president of the United States was, but, you know, some people did. What is driving James Henry Jackson? Is it tolerance of white nationalists in powerful positions in the government and elsewhere?
Well, actually, let's go further. You write, during the campaign, Donald Trump retweeted false statistics from a white supremacist website. He claimed that President Obama was not born in America. He has been supported by white supremacist groups and white supremacists, including David Duke. Are you asking if there's a line from Donald Trump directly to James Jackson?
I'm asking, are we creating a climate where this kind of hateful intolerance has become acceptable in the minds of extreme people, people on the fringes like this guy seemingly was?
Well, and you're also asking, why aren't more of us paying attention? And we did today. Jim Dwyer, thank you. We'll post Jim's column at herenow.org. Jim, thank you.
Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, March 25th, 2017. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have comments, questions, observations, counter-racist suggestions. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6. If you would like to participate. Before we get started, the COWS, listener-supported counter-racist radio. PayPal button, it's on our blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Again, racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you get to the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. For all the folks, please verify before you mail anything. I did move at the beginning of the year, so I have a new mailing address. Just drop an email to verify before you send anything off. The email again, untiljustice@gmail.com. That said, a few quick things that I wanted to touch on before we get to callers. First up, the segment about Wendy's, number one, I have said for years, myself, Pam, Dr. Kamau Kamban, many others, a major part of our counter-racist code should involve minimizing as much as possible, if not outright eliminating, eating out. I know that that's a big pleasure. I know we're groomed and conditioned that way from a young age, that that's a treat to be able to go out to eat, to go to a out to a restaurant and get some really good food. You don't have to go through all the the grueling work of cooking. A lot of people, you know, it's not the most fun thing to go in the kitchen and slave over a hot stove. Understood. Eating out, you are voluntarily subjecting yourself to major acts of racism, white supremacy. We've had a number of segments over the years to illustrate that. And the point from this segment at Wendy's, man, I hope that any of us have the black self-respect. If we go to an establishment, you know, we're stuck, we're hungry, we were not able to pack food, couldn't find a black-owned restaurant. We stop at an establishment and we see a receipt and it says nigger or spear chucker or whatever it is. I would hope we have the black self-respect, maybe, you know, the spirit of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. Whoa, black self-respect. That's right. I shouldn't be eating here in the first place. Let me get my picture, click, so that I can, whatever I want to do with the information. But I will make sure that I do not eat a nugget. In fact, I don't even want a napkin from this establishment. Thank you. I will, you know, take care of my meal needs down the road. Next, I thought it was so hugely important, the white supremacist attack this week in New York, that this white terrorist, number one, you know, checking the reports to see how regularly this incident was described as an act of terrorism. I did see white supremacist in a number of the reports, but I don't think they had as many directly calling this terrorism. That aside, I thought it was hugely important that this race soldier apparently stated that a part of the reason that he had to, you know, have this murderous rampage was because he was upset about black males being romantically involved with white women. Exactly what Dr. Francis Cress Welsing had talked about before. Exactly what Dylann Roof said. He was a little more coarse in his language, saying black males are raping white women. But you hear this over and over again, all the way back. Birth of a Nation was mentioned in the sound clips. I mentioned that in the article I had published on Camp of the Saints this week. But I mean, Dr. Welsing said that to precisely, scientifically, years ago, that she thought there were going to be more white men who were going to be engaging in acts of violence. She said she thought that might have even been driving some of these police shootings. The increased promotion of what they call interracial dating or interracial intercourse between black males and white women specifically. Right on time, her birthday was last week, Dr. Welsing. And mentioning that article with the Camp of Saints, I even had to do a little bit of advocating. Everybody, if you write, especially if you write professionally, you have editors, right? So sometimes that can be a process with editing. Sometimes, you know, you just have errors or, you know, your editor can strengthen your essay. Sometimes it can just be a style issue or you all just have a different perspective where you just try to find a compromise. In the edits, I wrote about the Camp of Saints explicitly, graphically talking about black male rapists that Western civilization, white supremacy, is on the decline and is about to fall, and this is a big part of it. Non-white people invading, coming to our parts of the world, raping our women and all of their sexual, you know, just danger and filth, and it's just going to contaminate our pure white race, quote unquote. This is like explicitly described in Camp of the Saints. And I said, I had something very early, just I think saying black rapists or something to that nature, which was important because this theme is repeated. And this was before the massacre in New York with James Harris Jackson, the white race soldier. And they took the rapist part out. And I think they just put dangerous black males. And I said, you know, this is not accurate. This book doesn't just say that black people are dangerous. This book explicitly, graphically states that black people are sexually dangerous, and they did change it back to sexually dangerous. That's the way it reads now, and right on time for what happened this week. Also, I want to make sure I got in, or I'll save it for later. Well, I'll put it out now. The segment with Donna Brazile, that was from the Young Turks, but that was talked about in a number of circles this week. Man, number one, when we talk about Mr. Fuller's concept of racial showcasing, that a black person, any non-white person, racist can put you in a position of power, and then they can decide, well, we have fulfilled whatever agenda that we needed you for, and now we're just going to treat you the way we treat all of the other niggers. That they can do that in very short order, and I think there are a number of examples where that is about exactly what happened. I think this could be another one, because I think Donna Brazile, I remember days after Hillary Clinton lost the election, her being yelled at, where some white person was yelling at her and saying that, you know, she cost, it was her fault that Hillary Clinton lost, that Donald Trump won the election, where they just find any nigger to blame and yell at. I just thought that whole thing was tacky and disgraceful. And some white person, could have even been Hillary Clinton, it would not surprise me at all if they, hey, you know, help our girl out. We want to see her win. Go ahead, Donna, come on. Make sure you get her those questions. That could have went down. And then she just ends up being the one who is found culpable, where they, you know, blast her and, oh, she's terrible and we got to fire her from CNN. And, you know, this is a disgrace to journalism. They are phenomenal at that sort of racist tactic, in my opinion. I'm eager to hear other people's thoughts on that as well. With that, we will get to the callers. Remind folks, if you could take 5 minutes to share your thoughts, views, I will prompt about that. That just makes sure everybody gets an opportunity to share at least one time. If we also could refrain from using metaphors. Just in my view, racist, a lot of times they will make comparisons, use analogies where they're comparing things that are not equivalent. In my view, this is a major tactic of racism. Victims, myself included, we have been trained by racists, so that greatly impacts our thought, speech, action, emotions. Emotional responses. And also, we are still learning. Sometimes we haven't come to a conclusion on a particular subject. We are still thinking on the matter. And so, in trying to articulate ourselves and our unprocessed, unfinished thoughts, we will employ a metaphor and hope that that conveys our thoughts. Many times it does not. It just adds to the confusion. If we could make as much of an effort as we can to be precise, direct, explicit with what we mean to say, no metaphors, I will prompt about that. If you're in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just helps preserve the audio quality of the broadcast. And no speakerphone. We have had some issues with that. No speakerphone, please. That also adds a lot of distortion to the line. The number again is 641-715-3640. The code 564-94-3#. Press *6 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
Good evening. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening to the host, the callers, the listeners. I just wanted to put out an acknowledgement. I was riding the bus today, and unfortunately, I saw a young black victim laid out on the ground in a pool of blood. I'm sorry if that was a metaphor, but it was literal because he was in his own blood. He was riding a motorcycle, and I'm assuming he got knocked off. So just for us as victims to just be especially careful and try our best to avoid doing reckless things. Additionally, an observation that I made, I was watching a television show. It's a show called Globe Trekker, and it's a travel show. And we don't really realize, because it's so insidious, racism, white supremacy, and everything. This particular white supremacist, I don't suspect he's a white supremacist. I am calling him outright a white supremacist. He went to India. And as I'm watching the show, I'm just kind of wondering, why didn't they send out someone maybe who was a little bit more inconspicuous? Why did it have to be a white person? But then I thought, that's how the system of racism, white supremacy works. It doesn't matter. These people can go anywhere. They can impose, they can impede on anyone's environment and atmosphere, and you as a victim have to accept it. And I'm just watching and observing a lot of the people in India. They're staring at this man, and he just looked so out of place, but it didn't matter. And one of the things that he did that really certified or signified for me that he was indeed a white supremacist was they were talking about an historical event that occurred where the British had invaded India and there was a massacre. And so they were speaking with an Indian historian, and he just spoke about the devastation that it caused, the amount of non-white life that this massacre had taken. And so this white supremacist said, he said, oh, but what about the railways that the British had brought to India? You know, that really helped out, didn't it? And, you know, I try not to be a violent person, but when I just think about and I just kind of ruminate on a lot of the devastation and the harm that these people commit, it's hard not to think violently about these people. And a quick question that I had for the other victims and the hosts, I'm going to end it off with this. There was that story about the quote-unquote reverse racism, but my question is, the reverse of racism, isn't that justice, or shouldn't that be considered justice? Just a question. I don't know how anyone else feels about that term, reverse racism, because it kind of sounds like an oxymoron, if I'm not mistaken. Thank you. I'll end it there.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hey. Yes, to the caller, I can definitely understand you believing that the opposite of that reverse racism should be called justice. Oh, and hello, everyone. You know, hosts, callers. I just want to make a couple of points. Number one, about the white terrorist, John Jackson, who killed Black Timothy Kaufman. Also, in newspaper articles I read, as well as internet articles, as customary, even though they talk about what a nice guy Kaufman was, there was the need to bring up his arrest records, the fact that he smoked marijuana and all of that. Meanwhile, when it came to the murderer, the terrorist, John Jackson, it was talking about his military service. He was honorably discharged and that sort of thing. And also the racial showcasing that you spoke of regarding Don Brazil, that could also apply this to Ms. Ayala, the Black district attorney. Now, the person who sent those threatening terroristic texts, that was a clerk, her employee, correct?
I don't know if he was her employee directly, but I know he worked, he was a state employee. I don't know if he worked directly under her. I thought he might have worked in a different department, so I don't know if he was her direct employee, but they're both state officials.
Okay, you know, it is, was really interesting, and how, you know, unfortunately, this is racial showcasing, and I have nothing but sympathy for Ms. Ayala, and I wish her well, but not one person mentioned that this is a crime, that criminal charges should be filed, terroristic charges. Nobody mentioned threatening a law enforcement official. None of this. So it's just really sad that she has this title, but apparently not the ways to back it up. Because I'm pretty sure had that been Angela Corey, you would have heard all of those things. He'd have already been charged with crimes. But in Ms. Ayala's case, it has to be a discussion when it shouldn't be. Oh, and also, on your Facebook post, you mentioned, Facebook page, you mentioned the show shots fired. Well, it's very telling that Derek Stafford, one of the two black cops from Louisiana, that was charged in 3 days killing that little white boy and wounding his criminal dad. He went on trial last week. The jury selection started on March 13th. And in 11 days, the verdict came in. Derek Stafford, black cop, guilty of manslaughter and attempted manslaughter. It just really is amazing how quickly the very law enforcement officials he worked for turned on him when he killed that little white boy and wounded his criminal dad. 3 days to complete an investigation and charge him with crimes. A month after he's arrested, he is fired from the Alexandria City Marshal's job that he had. He's in prison for 3 months, even though he belongs to two unions. But for some reason, no union official could come up with money for him. And now, only 11 days, a trial, he's convicted of manslaughter, and he's facing 60 years in prison. Meanwhile, Alton Sterling's white killers, that investigation's still going on. But this black cop, totally done. That's all I have to say.
Just for the record, Stan McCullers, that is the race soldier who said that the black female Armas Ayala, that she should be hung and tarred and feathered as well. He has since resigned, but his title was Assistant Finance Director at the Seminole County Clerk of Court and Comptroller's Office. So I don't know if that would have, like if he would have been directly working under her, like to say that, you know, he was her employee. But like I said, they're both state officials, or were both state officials. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, feel free.
Can I hear?
We'll get the female caller first. I heard both of you, though.
Yes.
Thank you, Gus. Hello to everyone on the line. My apologies. I was just able to tune in a few minutes ago, so I completely missed all the clips. However, what I do want to comment on is an article I read earlier this morning about football player Colin Kaepernick and him being whiteballed by racist men and racist women in the National Football Association. Mr. Kaepernick has not been picked up by an NFL team due to his national anthem protest. And I think it's bigger than that and more a statement to non-white black athletes that if you do try to stand up to racism in any way, shape, or form, your career will cease to exist, and therefore a way to provide for your family. Actually, I think it's beyond just the athletes. I think it's every non-white individual. I know that there are bigger issues for non-white black individuals than sports. I do think that what Mr. Kaepernick tried to convey is very relevant to non-white, specifically black individuals, when it comes to racism, white supremacy. Thank you very much, N1. I really appreciate the update on the black officer. I've been wondering what has been going on with his situation. And to know that he's been convicted in such a short period of time is not surprising at all in this system, but that just makes it more relevant for us as victims to stand up to the system and try to do as much as we can. Thank you very much, Gus. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
For sure.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Hey, Gus. Hey, callers. This is my second time calling in to the Cows. Last time I had talked about racial classification confusion, about the term biracial and the use of trying to use religions for racial classifications as well that I've seen. I want to talk about that again because I was actually wanted to comment about the Samuel Jackson comment of the casting of Get Out. But while I was taking my notes, I heard this term identity flexibility on the broadcast. And I was just about to talk about how using the term non-white is more important now than ever. And just hearing that, it really spoke to me. So what I was talking about, there has already been confusion as to what black is, especially during the so-called Black Power movement and the talk about the dark skin versus light skin and the status that the shade of skin color one has come with. Now this has seemed to go international, where now we have people scratching their heads on the movie Get Out about the casting of the main protagonist being a so-called black British person as opposed to someone who is so-called black American. So now, which is something Neely Fuller has pointed out, people have to question the meaning of the word black. I honestly think this is the logical progression of things because the only race on the planet is the white race. So by compensatory logic, that means the term black would need a new functional definition in the first place. The lady in all audio clips is feeling exhausted with being asked about her so-called multiracial identity, which only shows the confusion that the offspring of a tragic arrangement can produce if they do not identify as a victim of racism and are trying to find some kind of clarity while trying to work within the mindset of racist man and racist woman. And what I also wanted to say, I was just laughing to myself at whiteboard. I never heard that term before. And I think it actually is more appropriate reading Chris Welsing's papers. Whiteboard actually is a better term. So I'm not sure if it's safe to say that we live in a very eye-opening times when it comes to racism, white supremacy, but Donald Trump sitting there terrorizing an NFL quarterback for doing nothing but trying to bring light to racism and send help to people that need the most constructive help. Now I'm in a dilemma because at first I was going to stop watching any football and also going as far as not to play any football games licensed by the NFL or buy new or wear existing official NFL apparel. However, if POTUS is telling NFL owners to beware his Twitter fingers, saying he will send them out a tweet if they sign him, which basically sounds innocuous in a vacuum, but actually means that that organization will receive a lot of unwanted attention, could I really blame any owner for not wanting to deal with that tag? And I'll take my answer off the line.
Just make sure we are avoiding metaphors for the broadcast, but appreciate the commentary as well. Other folks have commentary that we have not heard from. Feel free, folks we have not heard from.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Excuse me, can I be heard? Great to see you guys and on to the other callers and the listeners. Great clips this evening, excuse me, and I wanted to start off with the missing children in Washington, D.C. Interestingly enough, my wife's best friend is from D.C., And he had made an interesting comment in regards to that recently. This was like yesterday or the day before. And he had said that he finds it to be, in his opinion, something very propagandist about this focus on the missing children. I think it was like 34 or something like that in the D.C. area, because he said that growing up there, that way higher numbers of children have been missing regularly. That's a regular occurrence, and no one's ever cared. So it was almost, in his mind, it was just basically, why are they paying attention to this group of children now, when all of these years have passed and no one's ever cared about the sheer high numbers that were way higher than that of missing children in that area. So I'm now wondering that too, just because he brought that up. I didn't really know. I'm not from D.C., but to hear him discuss it, he said, you know, he made it abundantly clear. He said the numbers were a lot higher throughout his life going up there, and there was never any sort of big deal made about it in regards to any sort of response by the media or anything of that nature. I've thought about that clip you played with the black female that was, you were just talking about it, that was threatened with tar and feathering and lynching. And it's just interesting because only white people get suspended with pay for giving out death threats. Nothing that white people do is ever taken seriously until they actually act on their thoughts and kill people. Outside of that context, they get suspended with pay. They don't even like lose their pay. I mean, I think you did say that he ended up resigning, but ultimately he didn't have to resign. He chose to resign because that's the kind of situation that white supremacy breeds, where you can be a criminal, commit a criminal act, and still get the control of your existence in the midst of supposedly being reprimanded. So I don't even know how that's being reprimanded when you're being suspended with pay. I wanted to ask, did you get the image that I sent you of the white man eating his child?
I did not. I've been behind on my email. I have to catch up.
Okay, because I sent you one. It's a white man. He has his child in a sandwich with lettuce, and he's in a giant bun, and he's eating the baby. And the baby, where he starts to eat from, is very telling, because he starts to eat the child, assimilate eating the child from the backside area. And I just found that to be telling after dealing with the left liberal Negro. So I just wanted to know if you got to see that. I can't wait till you do. It's going to be something else. Very interesting. It was a couple of things I wanted to bring up from workplace racism. Was I had a coworker, a white female, who just had a child a few months back, and she said something very interesting in passing to another white nurse that she works with. And she said she was at home with her child, and her sister-in-law was visiting them from out of town. And she said the baby was crying profusely. And she said, I really wish my sister-in-law was not there so I could just let him cry. So I was like, wow, and very interesting. So she doesn't care about her child. Newborn child doesn't care about the child. And if her sister-in-law wasn't there, she would have done what she wanted to do, which was basically leave him alone and let him bawl his head off. Very white of her as a so-called mother. And I had another coworker, a lesbian black female, who was in an internal company chat room, and she had posted a song for Most Def. I forget the exact song, but it was one of the songs where he's discussing black-related issues. And she put, for all the hashtag woke brothers and sisters out there. And this white guy chimes in and makes a comment about the song. And then they get into this discussion. And at some point in the discussion, he actually says, well, I'm a white male and the world revolves around me. And I was like, very interesting that he would put something like that out there in the chat room. And he understands the system of white supremacy probably a lot better than she does to actually state something like that in the public chat room. But that is white supremacy. That's how they function. Thank you very much, and I'll mute my line.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, everyone. I just had, just two brief things. Just to talk about the segment on James Jackson. I was actually reading, and I also saw on the news, I watch a lot of TV One. I feel like it has a decent amount of good information. But they said the assistant chief of New York Police, of the New York Police Department. They said that this white terrorist, he actually stabbed the victim with a 26-inch black mini sword. And I thought of Dr. Francis Quest Clothing when it came to that, as far as they always want to penetrate black men. And it's definitely telling that it was a what they described as a mini black sword. The other thing that I wanted to bring up is that my sister was actually talking about also about the missing children, and she had looked up on a website where it said that 3% of the children reported missing are black children. I'm assuming they might be quote unquote biracial, because of course in America we all assume that, or everyone assumes if you have, you know, a decent amount of black or a decent amount of melanin, I guess, then you're black. And I also just wanted to say that I know that some people in the past have spoken about their frustrations when they speak to their family members about, or when they try to speak to their family members about racism and white supremacy. And I just wanted to just say that, to, you know, definitely just be patient, because my sister had been going through that with me for years. And I just feel like, you know, I finally started to understand. So that's all I had to share today. Thank you. I'll mute myself.
Right on for your sister. Patience with other black people. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, folks we have not heard from at all. I can't believe we got everybody, because I'm still looking at hands. Other people that, if you have a hand up, your line should be open if you have a hand up.
Greetings.
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Yes, and also greetings to everyone else. I attended the quote-unquote mentoring program again today, and I guess this would be an example of the results of racism, white supremacy, which is the destructive behavior that non-white people impact on each other. The speaker today was a 40-year-old black male who was with his children in a vehicle, and a cousin of his who is happened to have been a NFL player, and they were literally ambushed by a carload of assailants. And he was, you know, talking to the young black males. This is what I'm specifically talking about in the meeting that we had today, just to inform them of the dangers of being associated with someone who has associations with someone or persons who are doing destructive things like this. He was not aware of the possibilities of something like this happening to him, and he was actually shot 11 times in this particular incident. And in turn, the person that the group of killers was trying to kill was his cousin, the NFL player. And without him knowing it, he just was explaining to the young people as an example of be careful about the people that you associate with. That brings things to home to me because I have a my offspring is a 21-year-old who I kind of like go over with him about understanding and knowing the company that that's around you and what they can possibly bring on a negative level things to you if you're not careful, to be careful about, you know, your associations. Unfortunately, under the global system of racial white supremacy, it's a concern that non-white people have with other non-white people have to they happen to be associated with, like a child or another loved one. In a sense, it's positive because you're instructing and you're sharing with young people about the possibilities that they may not have. They know it, but then they may not have totally thought out the subject matter. And somewhere along the lines, they may do some self-thinking about it and say, you know what, that makes sense on what that person is saying. And maybe I need to incorporate that when I'm by myself. And that's all I have today. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Yes, sir.
I didn't mean to interrupt. Sorry.
Oh, I was just thanking firefighter, and that was it. Proceed.
Oh, okay. Great. I just wanted to talk about the this is Ken Steele, and I'm in Southern California at the moment. And I just wanted to start by talking about the clip with the so-called biracial or multiracial or interracial. I don't know how she, I don't recall how she identified herself, simply because she used so many different and very confusing terms to explain her self-identity. I suspect that person being that's talking in the clip might be white. I did not see a picture of the person, but I noticed that there are a number of people that I suspect who are white that are in academic circles that try to claim that they're multiracial or multi-ethnic, but they look, act, and sound determinably white. And I suspect that that's exactly what's going on there. I know that there are a number of people, when the race discussion comes up, oftentimes there's a lot of confusion because oftentimes people misrepresent who their father is. And this might be a case of somebody claiming to be somebody claiming to have share ancestry with a person that says that they're their father, but it doesn't look like that's the case at all. So I, you know, whenever I hear somebody using very confusing language to describe their ethnicity, and then they look appear and sound like a typical white person, a typical racist suspect, I suspect that they are practicing racism. I've had academic suspected racists look at me dead in my eye and tell me that they were non-white, and they had Irish last names, red hair, freckles, all of the typical traits associated with suspected racists. So I don't think that this person that was talking in the clip was being very honest, or maybe she might be self-deluded, but I think that this is just something that occurs a lot in the academic field. It should be noted that Rachel Dolezal is an academic, I I believe she's an academic. She's published books, and she's given lectures. So, again, I think a lot of this confusing language finds its origins in academia, and it needs to be looked at and scrutinized very carefully by victims of racism. Also, regarding sports, the situation with Colin Kaepernick, I think it's particularly interesting that that it's gone all the way to the presidential level. I think it should be noted that the president just had a major defeat in the health care bill. So I think that by focusing on Colin Kaepernick, he's doing exactly what his base elected him to do, which is to mistreat and harm non-white people, particularly black people, and to do so in a very visible and public manner. And that's really all they care about. I don't think that they actually cared about reforming the health care system. I don't think that that was one of their main problems. I think that the problem that they had was the health care system was named after the first black president. So, you know, I think that by focusing on Colin Kaepernick, he's trying to get some sort of a win out of a week that was not very good for him. And I think that victims of racism should also be very aware that the only thing that can save this administration,
hang tight. We will have a moment of suspense before Mr. Steele gives us what will save this administration. Just hang tight so we can get the other folks who haven't shared, and then we can come back and get your additional commentary. Interestingly, both of those individuals, Colin Kaepernick, President Obama, non-white people with a white parent, Miss Gaither, I think is her name, Sarah Gaither, the person that did the segment on biracial identity, she might say that, hey, those are people who have, you know, this flexibility, identity flexibility. Maybe they're biracial and we need to acknowledge their white parent, their white ancestry. Other folks that we have not heard from at all who have a hand up, you should be with us as well. Other people that we have not heard from at all.
Yes, can I be heard?
I heard both of you. I guess we'll get our caller in Dakota first.
Oh, okay. Hey, man, how you everybody doing? I was in North Dakota, but I'm glad that I had made it back to Houston Friday. So my first observation, you know, I want to, pronounce my appreciation and love for black mothers and black grandmothers. So I was able to take my nephews to the bus stop, and I see that the black grandmamas is still doing the same thing they were doing when I was in school. They're making sure all the babies get on the bus. You know, they you see several grandmothers out there, 'cause my sister stay in a predominantly black neighborhood on the north side of Houston. And so, you know, you got all the grandmamas out there look waving, and then they look back and say, "That's all the kids?" And then the mama's like, "Yeah, that's all the kids." You know, but they all the way up there to the bus door with it, you know, making sure all the babies get on there. And now they got them where they got to wear ID badges. They got to scan their badge. So, you know, if anything happens, it's going to fall onto the school. So you know, the children, they, you know, they got to swipe their card when they get on, like they're clocking in and punching out. And with that, I also was going to, say great black self-respect for that lady. That's a black lady on the young person. The one that was, she was telling the white people exactly what they've been doing, you know, I'm guessing to their face. I mean, I think she's fine, black. But if she is, you know, black self-respect for her. And then about the clips, now, the racist has always been tricky with them words. Because now, if you look at when they say human trafficking, had something to do with prostitution and pimping, right? So now they're coming out with this children trafficking. Now, but this sounds like kidnapping.
you know, the way they saying it, the way the clip talking, somebody is stealing and kidnapping kids in Washington, D.C., you see. And we know who kidnapping kids. Ain't no, you know, ain't no secret. We know ain't no black people going around here snatching up no hundreds and thousands of kids, you know. But I also want to back though. Oh, excuse me for that metaphor, man. Agree with M1 on that man. That talk bad about that state attorney down there or whatever she was, attorney general. You know, yeah, they need to cut his tongue out. And then one more thing I have wanted to touch on, man. It's been so long, my brain moving too. Well, all right, I'm going to mute my line, man. Thank you for taking me though, girl.
Yes, sir. The other caller that spoke up simultaneously, did you want to share now?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, the host, the guests, and the callers and the listeners. I wanted to just start off with I think you call them affirmations. So I will end racism, white supremacy immediately. White people should eradicate themselves immediately. White people, eradicate yourselves immediately. Immediately eradicate yourselves. Immediately stop reproducing. Immediately. The other thing I wanted to say is an overview. White people are here to kill us. They came here to America to kill us. They found us here in America. And they've killed out a whole lot of us. That's how they acquired the land. That's what adverse possession means. That's how they acquired all the land of the globe, adverse possession. They come, they kill you. That's what they're here to do. That's what they're all here to do, and that's their purpose. They all know their purpose. I say that it's in their genetics to do this. It's part of their coding. Whether we created this creature or however this creature came about, it is the genetics of this creature is of white people or ice albinos or people who classify as white. I think that they're anti-black genetics, like even Dr. Welsing in her definition of racism, white supremacy. She says that the reason that white people are practicing racism, white supremacy, which is subjugating black people, and I think her definition is talking about killing black people. I'm sure her definition is about killing black people. And the reason that they do it is because of something about their genetics, something about them being an albino race, something about their genetics being so recessive that they cannot exist on this earth unless they kill black people. And that's the only way they can exist. And so if the only way they can exist is to kill black people, then they cannot exist. The other thing is it makes me sad to hear when black people talk about, you know, their strained relationship in their family. You know, that's occurred in my family. I think it occurs in all the victims of racism, white supremacy. I think it occurs in all of our families. I would just encourage you to, you know, if mend the situation if there's any way possible. A lot of times, well, let's just say mend the situation. And if there's any way possible. And then to my family, I would say, you know, let us be a counter-racist family. Let us eradicate racism, white supremacy as soon as humanly possible. White supremacy is white people. Let us meet at the family reunions with a purpose to strengthen our family and replace the system of white supremacy, racism, white supremacy, with the system of justice. And that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Right on. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, people that have a hand up, if you have not spoken at all, you should go ahead and speak now.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and to all the listeners and callers. Trailing off what that caller just said, I wanted to know if you guys heard of the term. I think they started a study back in like 2011 or 2013, and they deemed a term called natural decrease, meaning the population of white people basically at a it's on a decrease, it's on a downslope, and I was just wondering if which did birth the white whole white genocide movement and all of that. But I wanted to know that, you know, history taught us that when their numbers begin to deplete, they begin to invite other groups and pull them in as honorary whites and so forth. They're doing it with, you know, Hispanic community. They're doing it with different communities. But I just wanted to get your take or, you know, the caller's take on, you know, do you think that, who do you think they're going to, you know, pull in to, basically beef up their numbers and, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm just asking. I mean, do you think that that's a tactic which they have used? I mean, they use it with the Irish, the Italian. They use it through history. But I just wanted to get your opinion on that as far as the natural decrease of their population. And do you think that that eventually will kind of eradicate white supremacy or will they just invite other groups in and give them the, you know, the go ahead to continue the cycle of white supremacy, racism? I'll meet in the line.
Can I respond to the caller?
Other people can share their thoughts. I do still want to kind of pick up people that have not shared first. That way they can share their observations. They can respond to the question. And then once everybody's had one turn, then at any of the folks, if you want to answer the question, that'll be appreciated as well. Just my quick response, I have asked repeatedly, requested that we not use the term honorary white on the program. In my view, it promotes confusion. It's in Mr. Fuller's word guide as a word that he recommends not using. Either you are white or you are not. That is the counter-racist logic that I think we should be following. We have read exactly what he, and it's like a page. It's pretty lengthy, the reason explanation he provides in terms of not using that term, which I think is accurate. It almost suggests that you have a classification of white and a classification of honorary white, whatever that means. What is the difference? Is a white person a quote-unquote honorary white person? Who makes the decision about who is going to be quote-unquote honorary white? Just in my view, it promotes confusion. You either are white or you are not. As for the question about them adding, they have been doing that all throughout the system of racism, white supremacy. That's what white supremacy means. The most powerful racists, they do the classifying, and they can decide anytime they want to, and they can pick anybody they want to, and they have been doing that all throughout the system of racism, white supremacy. In my view, you even heard some of that in the sound clip today from Sarah Gaither, who in the clip herself said that she looks like, phenotypically, she looks like someone who would be classified as white. In my view, that's part of it right there, where if I want to, I can say that I'm white. And if I, phenotypically, the other powerful racists say, yep, we'll accept her as white, that's it right there. So they do that all day long, just understanding that's going to happen. The best that we can do is just try to point out that that's how the system of racism, white supremacy works in terms of them selecting who they want. And my view would be I don't think that natural decrease, I don't think that that in and of itself is going to end racism for the reason that I just gave. For racist man, racist woman, they can always just go around and pick, you know, how many other folks that they need and say, well, now we're going to decide that you are members of the white race. And so we just continue on with our system. I think they, when you have a system where you just make things up as you go, it gives you a lot of flexibility. I'll stop there. Folks that we have not heard from at all, did you want to comment? Just make sure we get everybody. Did we get everybody? Everybody who has a hand up has been heard from?
Thanks, Gus. I agree totally, Gus. Thanks.
I'm still learning myself. Folks can let me know if I am talking silly. So I'm going to take it that we got everybody, or at least everybody who has a hand up right now, you know, can speak. Okay. I heard both the folks that spoke up.
I just wanted to respond to the gentleman before me.
Proceed.
And I agree with you. I agree with you, Gus, not using the term honorary right, because I was talking about racial classification confusion, and I pretty much said trying to get into the mind of these races will only promote more confusion. So we should stay away from that, because they have been, I've seen it so much in the past 4 weeks. They've been revving it up so we can be more confused, and even being more confused as to what the prior racial classifications mean. So that's all I wanted to say.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I wanted to speak to, the murder of Mr. Timothy Kaufman. I'm from New York. I actually work in New York every day. And it's funny because that incident kind of helped me bring some counter-racist information to my wife recently. When I found out, because he was homeless and in transition into finding a permanent place to stay at the time he was killed. So the sad part is he was already being severely mistreated by the system of white supremacy, and then to take it to the next level, you get murdered while you're unassumingly walking down the street, as a more confused victim, not fully aware of battlefield awareness to protect yourself. And this really reminds me of Jeffrey Dahmer, because he actually, the killer, stalked another black male before he stalked the person he killed. They had him on camera. I guess they used the street cameras, and they have footage of him stalking another black male for at least about 3 blocks. The police claim that he was spooked. And when he was spooked, he diverted his attention from the original guy he was following and then started following the guy that he ended up killing. He walked up behind him. They said he stabbed him through the back, and the sword came out of his chest. And when the black male hit the ground, you could hear the sword hit the concrete. It made like a ching kind of a sound. They said he pulled the sword back out of his chest, and I guess as the black male turned around, was laying on his back and was pleading for his life, or asking him, like, why was he attacking him? He stabbed him a second time. They said he then ran to a McDonald's to clean himself up and went back to his hotel on 46th Street in Times Square. And the black male ended up running about 3 blocks to a midtown Manhattan precinct, where he collapsed and bled out. And I'm assuming that's probably why he died, because in moving, it makes your heart pump faster, which means he probably bled out a lot quicker. And this white male, like Jeffrey Dahmer, is a predator. He knew who to choose. He was stalking someone like a predator, and like white cowards do, they'll kill you from behind. And how this kind of helped me family-wise was that I told her, I said, that could have been me. I said, that could have been me just as easily as it was that person. And I said, that is why I deal with white people and treat them the way that I do. And I said, that's exactly why I function as a prisoner of war from the moment I step out of the door of my house. And when I said that to her, she wrote back to me, I guess, and she had said to me, I understand what you're talking about. And she said, try to stay positive. And I'm just like, in the moment you try to stay positive, but the reality is that could have been anybody. And ultimately we really have to be aware, because I could be wrong, because they didn't give this detail, but I'm assuming that the person he was originally following was probably more alert to his machinations, and he might have gotten nervous fearing a confrontation. And that's why he diverted his attention to the person who wasn't paying attention. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Hello, I could be heard.
Yes, sir.
Okay, yeah, man. See, the young brother, he brought my thought back to my mind. But Dr. Wilson, she said that we're supposed to know the game that we playing, right? Now, you know, you and Mr. Fuller, a lot of people has also concluded that war and been declared on us. We at war. Where people have declared war on us, right? So, you know, it's really, and then, I mean, I guess you could say we don't know how to do war. I mean, you could say it like that. But I have to agree with that brother and say that white people want to fear all black people. But what I think it is, they got this little thing about them where they got to be prestigious. You know, they got to be, the best people in the world, civil, you know, whatever you want to call it, whatever that little fake attitude they got, where they better than everybody. See, they got to maintain that. So it don't look right if they just come out and just march everybody somewhere and do another Nazi Germany. So what they doing, they going around knocking and getting the kids. They getting all these kids in D.C. They getting a whole bunch of Mexicans dying in Texas. You know, like over there in Mexico, they tearing coming up this, you see. And they doing it, and it's so subtle that it, like, people don't even really think that it is what it is. See, people will say, no, they ain't going to kill all of us. Because they can easily do that. But that's what they doing. When you really look at it, that's exactly what they're doing. They just doing it in their own way, you know. Because one thing for sure, they know that their numbers is in decline. They know that. They know that. And I mute my line, man. Oh, and yeah, I mute my line. Thank you. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the other callers. Thomas Smith in New York. This was in transportation to the plantation where I am now. Just had a few things to say. One is one of the ways in which they do that is give you an example here in New York, in the Bronx. The demographics is it says 43% white, 45% black, and 54% Latino. Now, if you could add, you would know that's way more than 100%. But how do they come up with that number? So they use Latinos as one of the examples to boost up their population, of the same way that Europe is using the Syrians now, and some of the people from the Middle East, those who are a lot lighter, will be classified as whites to boost up the white population. And also, I remember you read an article a few years ago, Gus, about California. And by a certain year, I believe it's coming up, whites will be no longer be the majority race. So they eliminated the word minority altogether. No one can use it. They won't be minority. That always stuck with me. So I just wanted to add that. I don't know if anyone brought this up. I wasn't able to hear all the clips. Did you talk about the guy who did the stabbing in New York, Us?
Yes, sir.
Jr.?
Yes, sir.
You know, I saw that story, and it kind of, a red flag went off in my head. Because it sounded familiar. It kind of gave me that deja vu feeling. And if you recall, a couple years ago, a black guy left Baltimore, come all the way to New York to kill some cops. You remember that? It kind of gave me that same feeling. Like, why would you leave Baltimore, come to New York to kill black people? I mean, Baltimore got black people everywhere. Just very strange to me. It just seems a little I don't know. It's just messing with my head how that whole thing's playing out. I don't know if, you know, you see the same thing, but either way, if it is what it is, you know, I as I expected with Trump, to see a influx in some of these type of incidents, direct violence against blacks, you know, just because that's what's, you know, that's how he's talking. The last thing I wanted to add, and I had an article I wanted to read a little bit of, however,
And for some reason right now, I can't find it. So I'll mute my line. Thank you for taking my call, Gus.
For sure. If it's worthy of your time and energy in the archives, or you can just look in the New York Times. They had an article Friday, or it might have been Thursday, right at the end of the week, that was talking about just that, comparing the terrorist attack in New York with Ismael Brinsley, is the name of the black male from, I think, right at the end of 2014. The suspect, he's suspected of killing two enforcement officials, December 2014. He wrote a report comparing the two, and then they did an interview with him as well. It's in the audio clips. James Harris Jackson, the race soldier.
Okay, I found the article, if I could read a little bit of it.
Yes, sir.
And it's a more recent one, but this one, the way it was written, I thought it was pretty compelling. And the numbers are higher now. This article was written in 2013. But just to show you the insurmountable problem we have and just how powerful white people are, this the name of this article, and it's from Fox News. American Hunters, the World's Largest Army. That's the name of it. And just to read a little bit of it, there were over 600,000 hunters this season in the state of Wisconsin. Over the last several months, Wisconsin hunters became the eighth largest army in the world, more men in arms than Iran, more than France and Germany combined. That number pales in comparison to the hunters in Pennsylvania, 750,000, and Michigan, who had 700,000, all of whom returned home safely after, I guess, they're trying to say they went to war with animals, but they came home safely. If you toss in a quarter million hunters in West Virginia, it literally establishes the fact that the hunters alone from those four states would comprise the largest army in the world. And that's not to add the other 46 states. I'll stop there. Just to show how compelling this is, a state has the eighth largest standing army. And a lot of times black people obfuscate, and they like to bring up other places, like somehow someone's going to come and save us. Just think about that. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Very sobering. Very sobering. I wanted to make sure I quoted Mr. Nero, white people kill for fun. Retired firefighter. I actually heard several people, but retired firefighter.
Yes, sir. I just recalled a incident earlier. Was going about the task that most of us have to do every year, file income tax. I guess that makes me a quote-unquote coon because you are practicing, you're working against your own best interest. actually paying for it in that sense. But that's not really the story. The story is story is actually in the office. My tax person is a black male. Everybody that was in the office was non-white black, except for it appeared to be a white female behind me in the waiting area. The televisions he had several televisions on, and they were pointed in different directions. So I guess so everybody can see the television. And it happened to have been a documentary with Mr. Michael Moore, I believe his name is, the obese white male, and one of his many documentaries. This documentary, and perhaps as I'm describing it, someone would know exactly what the title of it is. But anyway, he was kind of like almost like bragging about several places that have quote unquote free education, college education, and different things that he was bragging about. One of the places happened to be France, And he really made it look good, you know, with the idea of free college and the meals at lunchtime for the children is something that you would probably would see in an exclusive restaurant. And all of these great things. And I was just hearing the non-white people kind of like applauding him and applauding his observations. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. He's not telling the truth. He's not telling the truth. And I mentioned three examples, Vietnam, Haiti, and Algiers, for one thing. And I went about the task. It just gave me opportunity to go about the means of sharing some counter-racist understandings based on the people who call themselves French, which, you know, essentially is just white people who speak that particular language. They just because they're from somewhere that's called France, that does not make them people who are not on the suspect list, as Mr. Michael Morey is. So that was just something to report on. Thank you very much for listening.
Race soldiers in France are responsible for Planet of the Apes and Camp of the Saints. We heard you, Mr.
Hello.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Okay, so, yeah, what I was going to say is earlier is that, you know, the president's in a situation where they're calling his current situation a crisis. And as evidenced by his pivot to focusing on Colin Kaepernick, I think that the only thing that can restore the confidence and trust in his presidency amongst his base and I guess the greater racist public at large is an event that unifies racists against non-white people. And in the past, they have used, or it's suspected that they have used, so-called terrorist events. So I wouldn't be surprised if in the next few weeks, even, that they are going to make an effort to highlight any sort of activity by non-white people in a way that will inspire them to increase their war footing against us. So all of these one-offs that they're not discussing on a national in the White House, I think are going to be exacerbated as there is increasing difficulty for the current administration to conduct its affairs in an open manner and in the way that they want. So just be on the lookout for that. Also, one thing that I've noticed amongst some of my associates that get money outside of, I guess, what people would call normal or legal means. One thing that I'm noticing is that a number of them are getting set up by law enforcement. I had an associate who was, I guess, who got caught up in selling or acting as what they call a fence for stolen goods. And this is something that I noticed that in the last few months, there have been people that say, hey, I have a deal, or hey, I have a situation. And victims are getting themselves set up in these situations. Also, in my town of Chicago that I was recently located in, they've had two major gang sweeps in the last month. Two major gang sweeps, and each one of them resulting in over 50 arrests. So as they are discussing deporting non-white people from different countries, domestic non-white people or people who are currently citizens are being rounded up in large numbers and sent off to greater confinement without due process or representation that would afford them the ability to have their rights observed. So as things intensify for the current administration, expect them to try to distract from everything that's going on with them by increasing the activity that they're performing against us, both within the government and extrajudicially with these race soldiers doing these so-called random attacks. And I'll mute my lines there. Thank you so much.
Hopefully people will not wait till the last minute. If you have questions, observations, suggestions, we have about a half hour left on the broadcast. Go ahead, get your hand up now if you think you have something you would like to say. The number again is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If we had any folks who wanted to respond to the question that was posed about whether or not the natural decrease and if that will, how will that impact ending white supremacy, I guess that would be appreciated as well. Other folks have commentary?
Hey, guys, you know what I thought about on workplace racism this past week? You had discussed, well, there was this story brought up by one of the callers in regards to him being a trucker and how this white terrorist would, like, break into his car and, like, surprise him. It's basically stalking him and terrorizing him, and how he stopped him once he locked his doors and the white male had to wait outside the truck until he was finished writing up his paperwork and whatnot. And that was I believe it was the same day that the news broke out about the black male that was killed by the sword, the white man with the sword. And I thought of the same thing, that when the guy talked about being stalked and that's how he interpreted it. And I remember you also discussed that that's exactly what it is. And I said, that's exactly the results, is that kind of stalking and the importance of us just being vigilant and diligent about being aware of our surroundings, who's around us, what they're doing, because as black people, we just don't know what type of psychopath we're going to come into contact with on a daily basis. And for me, that's how I function all the time. And I always just keep something on me. So if I happen to come upon some white person who acts out of turn and I have to put them down, then it's just going to be what it is. And we just have to be very vigilant, because these beings are just, they're terrorists, they're psychopathic, they're sociopathic, and I, just like the earlier call said, they want to kill us, they want to kill all of us. I think the Delectable Negro should give us more than enough insight into what white people are all about when it comes to black people. Thank you very much. And in reference to natural decline and how that could help end the system, the best thing it can do as far as helping end the system is just getting rid of white folks. And it doesn't mean that getting rid of them is going to get rid of the system, because even if they disappeared overnight, the damage that has been done to all of us by the hierarchy and the system that they've put in place will still leave a lot of work for us to do just to fix the mental damage that they have inflicted on all of us to regress us to the point where we act like them. So the best thing it would do is would be to get rid of racist man, racist woman, racist child, racist retard, racist elderly, racist fetus, just get rid of them all. And that to me is one of the first big steps in the right direction. The less we have to deal with them directly, the better it will be. But like I said, there'll be a lot of work for us to do, to reverse the mental damage that's been done to us all. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, he actually just brought up one of my memories of a past workplace situation when he brought up the racist retard or racist mentally challenged person. I used to work at a nursing home, and I worked, sometimes I would work in the dementia unit, and there was this white woman. She wasn't really all that old. She was actually involved in some type of car accident, whether she was hit by a car or actually in the car, I can't quite remember. But I remember specifically, even though she couldn't take care of herself, as she seemed like, you know, the accident took away most of her cognitive skills, I guess, she still knew who was a nigger, who wasn't a nigger. She would call us niggers, and she would, and the crazy thing was that there were some quote-unquote homosexual black men or same gender loving black males who also worked there. She would call them BITCHASS niggers. So I just thought that it's like, you know, they can even be, they're still very, very efficient with their racism, no matter what state of mind they're in. That's all I had. Oh, and I have been starting to read the book Camp of the Saints, and it definitely starts out it starts out as being racist, and it puts it all basically on page one. Thank you, and that's all I have.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I was talking to my brother earlier today, and we were speaking of the Khalif Browder situation and what he was put through mentally as far as, you know, being incarcerated and the mental torture and everything. And for me to hear that other caller say that every time he steps out of his house, he makes sure he's prepared. He's, you know, because he doesn't know, you know, when the predator could pounce. And they said that Khalif Browder basically was going through PST, post-traumatic syndrome?
PTSD. Disorder.
Yes. At least I would like to ask everybody online, could it be reclassified as current traumatic stress disorder instead of post? Because there's no post. It's not over. It's not stopped. It's not decreased. It's actually increased. So shouldn't it be reclassified as current, CTSD? And I'll mute my line.
I think the logic of that, I think, is absolutely correct and important, because it's not, the mistreatment has not ceased. I think we've had some of these discussions in the context of healing, and generally you don't heal until the injury has stopped, and the injury of white supremacy is ongoing, because the violence is ongoing. So absolutely, I think that, and I use that same logic when I talk about the term victim, because a lot of non-white people, they reject being referred to as victims of racism, and I say it is for sure accurate, and in my view, important, because it correctly articulates what our position is, and it's ongoing. It's not just that they, you know, mistreated us yesterday. This is every second, because we're being victim. I mean, they're polluting the water. That's every second. You need water every day. They're polluting the air and all areas of people activity. This is ongoing terrorism. So in my view, it's absolutely correct and important.
Can I be heard?
Heard both of you.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to the two topics. The first one being the post-traumatic stress disorder. I do agree that we do have to start looking at these things in terms of being victims of racism. Just like how they talk about how our predisposed heart rate, high blood pressure, heart disease is based on, having stress, and, we're predisposed to it, but it's never in the context of continuously being victims of racism. So that's my first thing. And the second part is about the natural decline of white people being the end of racism. And I do agree that the numbers really do matter when it comes to it, but when it comes to neutralizing racists on the job or anywhere else, it just comes to how you interact with them. And I just think, I really emphasize just limiting and just very much so minimizing your contact and interaction with white people, if you can avoid them at all costs. I think that would be one of the best ways to neutralize it on a, you know, on a personal individual scale, to neutralize racists on white people. That's all.
Happy heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. That was a great observation on current traumatic disorder. I think that is logical. I had a workplace one to share. It happened the day before yesterday. And I told you when I work in the OR, there's a white technician who told me that she took the job because she likes the size of the black male's penis and so forth and so on. So this white technician is generally very helpful to me at night. So, being that she is helpful and I do need her help sometimes, you know, I'm very cordial. And the other night we had a couple of shootings. I wanted to get some information from her. So I, wanted to know, what happened and where were the people shot at and if they survived and all those types of things. And later that evening, she came over to me and she says, Thomas, can you help me out here? So I said, yeah, what's up? And she's doing her paperwork and she asked me how to spell meeting. And I'm like a meeting? Like me and you have a meeting? You know, like, she's like, yeah. So I'm like, M. And she wrote a N. I said, no, M, it has two humps. So, she put the two humps and then I said E and she wrote a A. And I said, no, E. So either way, that's how it was spelled. Now here this chick is a technician in the hospital. She can't spell meeting. She doesn't even know her letters. And I just don't, only in the system of racism and white supremacy did this happen. I just thought that was very interesting. And also, I was watching a movie, and I was told this movie had a lot of racist rhetoric inside of it, so that's why I watched it. And I wasn't, it didn't disappoint at all. It had a very huge welding moment. And I just want to know if you have seen it, Gus, or any other callers. It's called The Hateful Eight by Quentin Tarantino. I just thought that it was very interesting. And it has a lot of racism in it if you watch it. I'm mute my line. Thank you.
I have not seen it. I didn't want to get in. I didn't include the clip. I could have easily, but I'll mention it. There was a report of a young black female. She's 13 in Florida, retired firefighter, where she was being terrorized at school. And it got so bad that she had to leave the school. There was a white woman. They posted this report online. There was a white woman, suspected race soldier. Her name is, or she posted under the tag of Jen Lynn. She got on this post, and this is standard racism, white supremacy. I generally don't, get down to with social media too much, but I just saw this, and all the time, she writes, I had this same thing happen to me, only it was a cow, not a gorilla. One of the things that they did was they photoshopped images of this teenage black girl. They put ape faces on her, right? Standard tackiness, racist tackiness. So the white woman continues, it was a cow, not a gorilla, and I was one of the only few white people in a black school. I ended up going to a private school. I'm so glad she was strong enough to say something. Bullying should never be allowed. I hope that she will not allow this to change her in any way except for the better. And yay, all these folks applaud and what have you. And just in my, I did respond, but in my view, that is whites, they do this sort of thing all the time, where a black person, victim of white supremacy, The attention is on them and the abuse, the white abuse that they have been subjected to. And the whites will run in. Oh, I was a victim and a black person, they mugged me, or a black person, they raped me, or a black person stole the job that I have. And, you know, bullying happens to everyone. And we just want to try to get along and be better people. They do this sort of thing all the time. And it's generally very effective at moving the focus away from black people, victims of white terrorism, and the black person getting attention and help, to, oh, you should come and, you know, focus on me, white person, and definitely stop thinking about talking about white supremacy racism. Standard racist tactic. That's something I just think folks should be alert to. It happens frequently. Other folks have commentary?
I call that super victim. White people are always the superhero and the super victim at the same time in this narrative of white supremacy. It's unfortunate, but they always find a way to be the victim when they're even at the expense of someone else. You know, it's always a way they could include themselves in there, something that happened to them, and sue Africa for the situation.
The legend, Sue Africa, one and only. Did other folks have commentary?
Yes, I did. There's something that article that I saw that stood out earlier, and what they said was that cars are the new vehicles for terrorism. And it just made me think that people also, black people just want to be very alert when traveling on the street, and especially if you're on crowded streets in large groups, because that does seem to be the new trend now, taking SUVs and plowing into a bunch of people, or cars and just running through a bunch of people. That seems to be like the new thing now. And it's just something that we just want to be vigilant about. Weirdly enough, I had an incident like that myself, but this was before this became a trend. I was actually just going to work one evening. This was, man, a long time ago, but I was crossing the street. This was at 42nd Street outside of Grand Central Station. I was crossing Lexington Avenue, and I was waiting on the curb, and I was standing next to this elderly white woman, and there was a break in the traffic, so I just dipped across the street before the light actually changed. So I go to the building, go in the elevator, and I go up to the third floor where my job was. And as I get off the elevator, I see everybody rushing to the window. So I go to the window, and I'm asking, hey, what's going on? So they were telling me, oh, this old white lady just got hit by a car. And when I went to the window, the woman that I was standing next to got hit, and she ended up getting killed because the taxi cab jumped the curb trying to dodge the snarled traffic, hit her. She died, and it pulled off into the traffic and disappeared, and they were never caught. And I was like, I was just standing next to that lady like 5 minutes ago. And so this just reading that article brought that to mind for us to just be very vigilant when we're in public spaces, and especially if you choose to be in a place that's crowded, because that's when it seems like they like to do this thing where they're plowing into, you know, tens of dozens of people, or, you know, that whatever the case may be. Thank you.
Great suggestion. I'm agoraphobic anyway. I'm not into big crowds and those type of scenes, but I definitely in the system of white supremacy, just being alert. Even if you, if you are into all of that, you want to go out and have a good time, that's great. But just recognize we're in a system of white supremacy. Be alert to the whites that are around you. I would say especially be alert if there's alcohol involved, and already be paying attention. You know, if things look like this situation might be getting a little bit unsafe, I already know the route, you know, in terms of how I can get out of here quickly, and should have these type of discussions. If you have offspring, family, as they call it, have these type of discussions as a group. So, you know, everybody knows what the plan is if you know, something should happen, unfortunately.
Hey, Gus, that's a great phobia to have. Over the years, I've become the same way. I used to be in the music business and performing and being around crowds of people. And as I got older and I broke away from that entire way of life, That's something that I don't do anymore, as far as just being around big crowds and just large groups of people. And whenever I'm on the street, just highly alert. I just don't play around. The same kind of alertness and mentality I have when I was doing negative things is the same sort of mentality, but without the negative things. It's more on some life-saving codification. Thank you.
And make sure you listen to yourself. Sometimes the universe, it sends you signals. You got to pay attention to those signals. I might not. There might be better words to articulate what I hope is coming across, but just you really got to be alert. You got to pay attention to that. One example I can give, I was going to the store. I thought it was going to be a relatively quick shopping experience, and it was for the most part. But as I was entering, there were two white men. They looked like they were probably in their 20s, but they were, you could tell they were intoxicated. I could tell they were intoxicated. They're in front of me, and I immediately said, oh, okay, I'm going to keep be alert of them the whole time that I'm here, and, you know, just to be mindful that this could be an issue. Whites, alcohol, I talk about that all the time. Sure enough, I go to exit, we check out, and they're in front, and I purposely, because I already knew this could be a problem, I gave extra space. I didn't, you know, stand where I normally would in the line. I gave about an extra probably 10 feet, like it was a considerable gap. Sure enough, they got tacky and terroristic, and I do what I have said consistently. I ignore, and it went from that to just name-calling and cursing and all of that, and I continued to do the exact same thing, ignore. They leave, and I waited for them to exit in their vehicle, and then I exit. Just got to be alert, and the whole point of me saying all of that, I saw this could be a danger from the beginning. That's why I said you really got to pay attention when you get those signals. Trust yourself, the universe. Sometimes you get clues about things that are happening, things that are going to happen. You got to pay attention, and you got to trust yourself when you get that information. I think Mr. Fuller even says that sometimes the creator sends signals just to you. You got to trust those signals, and I think the system of white supremacy does a lot in undermining black self-respect for us to kind of ignore those things, to devalue it, to minimize our thoughts and feelings. Really pay attention. And in my view, when you go into a restaurant and you see a receipt that has nigger on it, that might be a signal. Maybe I shouldn't put anything in my mouth from this restaurant. Things like that. Signals from the creator. That's how I view them. Folks have other commentary they wanted to get in last few minutes.
Okay, I'll be here. I'll let you go first.
Okay.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Hello? Yes, sir.
Well, I just, I clicked over, man, and I'm sorry. I was on the other line, and I just went on and purchased the URL for a current traumatic. I'm about to patent that. And we might try to get us a class action lawsuit on this, because what you were just describing was PTSD. I'm telling you, you should not have to live under those conditions. I'm going to get some physicians to back me up, and I'm about to make a big deal of this, y'all. I'm serious. So back me up. I'm done. Peace.
Great, great, great. Other folks have, I heard a few folks, other folks want to go ahead and comment in the last few minutes.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that's awesome as well. I kind of find it funny that you use the word when God sends you signals, follow them. I was just thinking about commentary that's I guess a couple of people had on Barack Obama last week after hearing the audio clip, and I just I really appreciate the emphasis that you put on Gus. You put on having patience, trying to practice patience with other black people. And with that said, I was just wondering if this was the appropriate program to use VGQ about that situation.
VGQ about being patient with other black people?
Or more sort of like what can be done about, you know, the Obama situation or looking at other non-white people in power?
Oh, I guess if you want to share your view, I am kind of done with President Obama. Like, he's out of office now. Folks had 8 years to say whatever they want to about him. All of that is done. So I am at a loss as to, you know, what the point is to further, you know, critique or criticize what he did or shouldn't have done since he's gone. If it's an Obama thing, I'd, you know, prefer to fast forward that.
Right. And I agree with you. And that's why I wanted to talk about what can be done.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to actually use a recent event about Steve Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
People were actually coming at him about why he was telling people to respect the president.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were other famous people that were talking about that. And I'm just like, if we're going to use compensatory logic about this, I think when the president of the United States cannot produce justice for you, I just think that people individually should elect themselves to produce justice, not looking towards anyone else to do so, because that will fail you every time. A victim of racism, I do not think can help another victim of racism not be a victim of racism. Otherwise, they would not be a victim of racism themselves. So I just think that would go a long way for stopping us from calling other non-white people coons, calling other white non-white people sellouts. It'll just put the responsibility on yourself. Like, all right, this is what I'm going to do on any given day, anywhere I happen to be on the planet. So I think that's the appropriate response as to what can be done about the Obama being president situation, and just kind of knock out all this talk about what he did or didn't do. Let's just forget about that. That's all.
I see the logic in that. I think I was a little bit confused because I thought you said earlier in your response, you had said people in power, and then you said Steve Harvey. And I was like, whoa, I'm trying to follow, but I got it after made me work a little bit harder to process, but I got it. Do we have other folks who wanted to comment in the last few minutes?
Yes, I wanted to give out a book title for everyone. I think this is a title that you would be interested in as well. It's called White Women, Black Men, Illicit Sex in the 19th Century South. The author is Martha Hodes, Hodes. And on the back of the book, it says this book is the first to explore the history of a powerful category of illicit sex in America's past, liaisons between Southern white women and black men. In telling a series of stories about such liaisons in the years before the Civil War, Martha Hodes explores the complex ways in which white Southerners tolerated these relationships in the slave South and shows how and why these responses changed with emancipation. So I think it's going to be a very interesting read. I haven't read it yet, but it got very good reviews. I think, I'm not sure if the author is a black woman, but it might be, I'm not sure. And I just find it to be fascinating, especially after going through The Delectable Negro and seeing what white women were capable of. I would like to just find out more about this, because I'm pretty sure it's going to be treasure troves of racism, white supremacy, since that's where the most acute forms of racism are practiced in the bedroom. Thank you.
Haven't read it, but I do own that book. Other folks have commentary they wanted to get in? Last few minutes.
I just think we're going to be hearing about a whole lot of racial classification feuds in the next few months. It's been getting up there already, so yeah.
I concur. Anything else folks wanted to make sure they get in? Last few moments.
I would say that I'm a...
Go ahead.
I'll wait till you're done, sir.
Mm-hmm.
No, just very short. I would say I'm a little tired of people asking me, have I seen the movie Get Out? it's not a desire for me to go to the movies, quote-unquote. I guess eventually in time... I would watched the movie, but I'm not necessarily motivated to watch it. I always suspect when something about racism, white supremacy comes on.
Well, speakerphone
comes on. I do suspect every time a movie or something comes on television and or the movies about racism, that eventually some course in time is going to be a white person or someone a white person wants to be to solve the problems, so to speak. And anyway, I don't get angry at the non-white black person who asks me about it. I just answer the question, which is no, I haven't seen it yet. But that was just a thought. Thank you.
I was going to say, instead of going to see the movie, why don't we do what the movie says? Get out and as far away from white people as possible. Follow the instructions in the film. You don't need to see it to understand what it's telling you. Get out. And if you're in a relationship, a tragic, horrible arrangement, get out. Get as far away from that predator as possible if you can do so as quickly as possible. That is, follow the message, not the movie. And in reference to the CTSD, it was myself that was building with Mel about that earlier today. And we just started really discussing this. I think we're going to end up building a website where we document current traumatic stress disorder events, which would include things like workplace racism, shows from the cows, and just regular events where we can see white people acting white. And hopefully if we can compile enough of those and get that information to the medical industry, they can update the records to reflect the reality that we are in a current state of permanent stress disorder due to the system of white supremacy. And until we eradicate that system and those who classify themselves as white, who are the origins, progenitors, and perpetuators of the system, we're going to continue to have that problem. It should never be post-traumatic stress. Post-traumatic stress are for the white soldiers who have gone overseas to murder non-white people and come back. It's post for them because they're not in the field killing non-white people. But for everyone who's non-white, it's a current state of traumatic stress, and it is a disorder. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
They're going to be saying James Harris Jackson was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder very soon, I suspect, and that'll be his disorder. Even, in fact, I'm reminded, before we get Ken Steele, I'm reminded there was a report that was saying that white supremacist outfits, that they were recruiting white people like race soldier James Harris Jackson to come join their ranks because they had all sorts of expertise in killing. And explosives and firearms, that these are valuable assets. We want to recruit them to our cause, the more crude white supremacist outfits. I have not heard that advanced. If that should be a problem, that we should be looking at more of these white veterans who might have these sorts of, you know, white terrorist leanings. Mr. Steele?
Yes, white veterans have a number of organizations that are, I guess you could call them paramilitary organizations that operate in plain sight within the armed forces amongst active duty soldiers and veterans alike. These groups include the Three Percenters and the Oath Keepers. Those are the two main groups that I've been made aware of over the last few years. And also, there's a report that I just saw saying that there's a so-called transphobic, so-called, they're calling themselves a free speech bus to travel across the country, and it has white children or white stick figures saying that it's biology, boys are boys and always will be, girls are girls and always will be, sign now to defend freedom of speech. And I suspect that this is a white genocide themed bus, because all the type is in white, They're making mentions of free speech, and don't be surprised if you see this bus in your town broadcasting blatantly racist rhetoric. They will transition from the so-called transphobic rhetoric to the outright white supremacist, white genocide. And this is the free speech bus. Thank you so much.
Right on.
I wanted to add to those I wanted to add to those paramilitary organizations, because the Klan was paramilitary. They were made up of white people that went to war. The Hell's Angels were also made up of white racists that were in the military. They created the Hell's Angels as well. So a lot of these groups, their tentacles, or I should say, they have a very far-reaching impact on white American society, and as a byproduct, us as well. And the white race soldier who killed the black male in Midtown Manhattan with the sword, he also made it abundantly clear, because he actually got away with the killing. He actually, once he went to a McDonald's after killing him to clean up the blood off of his clothes to make himself presentable, he went back to his hotel room, they said, and he sat there for 24 hours awaiting the news to report the killing. And once it was reported, he actually turned himself into the police. If he didn't turn himself in, they would have never caught him. So he wanted, like Dylan Roof, he wanted to be famous for what he had done. And he actually said that as far as in the article that I read, that he actually made it clear that he wanted it to be known that it was him who committed that crime. And he was hoping and planning to commit more, but just turn himself in before he could do so. And also, I was going to ask us, since you're such an avid reader, if you've ever read that book, Black Like Me, and if you think that's a book we should read sometime down the road on the couch.
Is that the book where the suspected racist, he turns himself black so he can experience racism?
Yes.
Yeah. I have started it and stopped it. I read like the first 60%, 70%. It just got stalled. I've seen the movie as well. It is pretty interesting. We've talked about it on the program before. I know some listeners, they're avid fans. It's like in their top 10. So it might be something that we read later. But yeah, I am familiar with it.
Okay, because you know that they also had an updated article where a white male did the same thing in 1994. It's called Black Like Me 94. And he couldn't do it for like 24 hours. it was just incredible. But yeah, I think that might be a good text to maybe read down the road. Thanks again.
Yes, sir. That will do it. 3 hours for the compensatory call-in. We should have a white woman on the program, a white female reverend, no less. She wrote a big article in the New York Times earlier this month about discussing racism specifically with white children. She said that white children, if we do not speak to them, give them correct information about justice and not being racist, that they just absorb all of the default material and they go out and practice racism. That was part of the, I'm paraphrasing, but that was part of the, what she talked about in her report. She also has written a book about racism, white supremacy. She should be visiting on Wednesday. I'll post the article so folks can read if you want to do some prep work before Wednesday. Workplace Racism every Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Friday, brand new book. We should be starting the biography on Coretta Scott King. It was just published this year, which she co-authored, My Life, My Love, My Legacy. Just came out, as I said. Got the audiobook. I already had the book, but now I have the audiobook, so we can break it up and do it on the book club beginning this Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have questions, guest suggestions, if you are trying to find something in the archives, drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks to all the folks for tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. I will say again, I know it is getting warmer, so more people are spending time outside, enjoying the warmer weather. That's great. Racism, white supremacy remains. So sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I think we want to be alert so that we can be paying attention to things that are happening around us, especially we're out in public, whites are around. you never know. There is not just one James Harris Jackson, Dylan Roof, Darren Wilson. There are lots of race soldiers, badge or no. You really want to make sure that you're able to function at your best so you can see if there are potential dangers, hazards, racists that you might need to avoid and to figure out what the best strategy is to neutralize any of those dangers. Sobriety would be best. Dr. Welsing, Dr. Kanban, Mr. Fuller, I think a number of our guests, revered guests, I think they would co-sign on that one. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.